yonder.
I appreciate, and I appreciate the people in the audience who have also done great work on the issues that we've dealt with in the Human Services Committee. So thank you all, thank you, committee. So the first issue we're going to be hearing from is an informational meeting regarding kids, protecting kids from tobacco use, the relationship of an increase in youth hookah smoking, and exemptions to the Indoor Clean Air Act. So Katie and Katrina Hedberg. Katie, you're not coming? Okay. Okay, if anybody would like copies, if you need a paper copy of an LC, if you didn't get by email.
Don't worry about me.
Okay, if anybody puts up their hand if you need something. All right. Welcome.
Just hit the...
Everyone is different. Just do what?
Just click where you did right there, and, no, yeah.
See, this is slideshow two.
Well, thank you very much. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Katrina Hedberg. I'm the state epidemiologist with the Oregon Health Authority. And it's my pleasure to be here this morning to talk to you a little bit about what's happening with the Indoor Clean Air Act in Oregon, and specifically what's happening with hookah lounges that are opening, and how that seems to be affecting hookah use among our youth. So tobacco continues to be the leading cause of preventable death in Oregon. It attributes at least 7,000 deaths a year, and that includes 800 deaths due to exposure to secondhand smoke. Now, when people smoke as adults, they usually don't sort of start smoking at age 40 or 50 and become lifetime users. Basically, people who smoke tend to have become users as youth. They have tried tobacco products when they're younger, and then get addicted to nicotine, which is an incredibly addictive substance. About a third of the teens who try smoking during high school become daily users before they leave high school. And of those, about a third will end up dying prematurely from a tobacco-related illness, whether it be a cancer, lung cancers, heart disease, lung disease such as emphysema or chronic bronchitis. So the good news is that since the tobacco prevention and education program started in the mid-1990s, we've seen a decline in the prevalence or the percentage of adults who smoke from about 25% down to 17%. And this has also been mirrored by smoking among our teens. This graph here shows cigarette smoking by 11th grade students in Oregon. The top line, well, both Oregon and the United States, the top line, the darker bar, is what the smoking rate in the U.S. teens, and then the lower, the lighter blue, is the smoking, cigarette smoking by Oregon youth. And so you can see that Oregon has been doing better overall than the United States. That said, the numbers are leveling off in the last couple of years. So if we look at the specific type of tobacco that's being used by 11th graders, you can see, again, overall there has been a decline. That's the very decline in cigarette use, the top line. The bottom line, the very light color there, is 11th grade smokeless tobacco use, also seen a decline. The middle line, however, is 11th grade hookah use, and you can see that that's the one area where we've seen an increase in tobacco use among 11th graders. So what is hookah? We have a model right here. Hookah is a water pipe. It's originated likely in the Middle East. And what happens is that the hookah, the top of it, is where the bowl is, and the tobacco is placed in there. And the tobacco products, and I think do we have a sample that that you all can see? So this, it is tobacco, but it goes by the name shisha. And what shisha is, it's a flavored tobacco, and they usually flavor it with some kind of different either fruit flavors, candy flavors, alcoholic beverage flavors like margarita, those kinds of things. And it's also added with kind of a syrup or something that makes it sweet. And so this product, as you can see and feel it, it's very thick and gooey, and it doesn't burn on its own. So the bowl at the top is where you place the tobacco, and then there are coals. There should be a long kind of stick that you can all see. That's the charcoal that needs to be burnt in order for the tobacco to smolder. Then it gets, the bottom of it is the base, and that is the water pipe part of this. It's filled with water. And obviously, what happens is these two hoses, this one has two, some of them have more, some of them may only have one, but when someone inhales, the smoke from the top, the tobacco goes down through the water at the bottom and then gets inhaled through these two hoses. Now, what happens with this, the flavoring of the tobacco, as well as the fact that it's cooled in water, means that a lot of people it doesn't feel as harsh as other tobaccos. It doesn't feel as harsh as smoking a cigarette. So a lot of youth don't feel or believe that hookah use or tobacco in hookah is as dangerous as cigarette use. However, it is still tobacco, even though it goes by the name of shisha. And this shisha tobacco delivers nicotine, just like other tobacco, which is highly addictive. And in addition, the hookah users inhale very large volumes of smoke, as much as 100 cigarettes in a single session. And again, I don't think people may not be aware of it, in part because the flavoring and the cooling of the smoke. But the risks of smoking this type of tobacco are the same as with other diseases caused by cigarette smoking. You're still inhaling smoke. So this is a graph. I mentioned what the flavoring, and you can see there the advertising for this hookah is really, or these lounges, very kind of exotic use, and you can see this variety of names that this goes by. Now, it turns out that flavored tobacco is banned for cigarettes, in part because these flavorings do appeal to youth, and so one of the efforts that's been made at a federal level, I smell that tobacco here, is that it's been banned from cigarettes. However, it has not been banned for hookah use, so the flavored tobacco, again, is allowed. So the Indoor Clean Air Act was fully implemented in January of 2009. It prohibits smoking in indoor workplaces and public places with a couple of exceptions. One is cigar bars, which are places, obviously, where people go to smoke cigars, and many of those were grandfathered in existence prior to the law taking effect. But in addition, the Indoor Clean Air Act does allow for smoke shops to be certified. Now, smoke shops, we believe the intention here was for people to go and sample a high-end tobacco product or whatever that they would then purchase and take off-site and use elsewhere, but they were allowed to sample the product indoors. A lot of the hookah lounges are seeking certification as smoke shops, and so they say even though these lounges people are the go and smoke on-site and, of course, do purchase some of this and may take it home as well, but they really are a site. They aren't just sampling. They're using it in the hookah lounges. So part of the reason that we're as concerned about this as we are is that the predictors of youth, again, starting using tobacco and potentially becoming lifetime users, really do relate to a number of things, including what their peers think about tobacco tobacco use. And we did some focus groups of youth and their parents to find out what they were thinking about hookah specifically. So it's both predictors of using tobacco include what your peers think, and when asked about this in the focus groups. In fact, the teens say that hookah use is perceived to be common and accepted by their peers. And I have a son in high school. He's a 17-year-old, and when I asked him about hookah use, it's very common. They talk about it. They know about it within the high school setting. So it is a relatively accepted practice, if you will. Another predictor is whether your friends smoke. And again, hookah is a social activity, as you can see by this model here that has the two hoses. The lower risk perception that there's health problems, and again, hookah is not seen as harmful, and probably in part because it doesn't feel as harmful to the people who are trying it. And then again, the flavored tobacco tends to be particularly appealing to youth and young adults, and which is exactly what shisha is. So a couple pictures about the different types of hookah lounges. This is in a setting of kind of a bar club where you can see people are, you know, mingling and dancing and doing those kinds of things. There's also more private settings. These are house parties. Again, not all of this is done in these shops. It's also purchased and taken home. And particularly this one on the right, you can see these boys look pretty young to me. Tobacco use, you have to be 18 and older, but it's clear that when you're allowed, youth younger than that, these high school students, as I showed, do have access to tobacco products as well, unfortunately. Here's a hookah lounge, and you can see, again, people sitting around and sharing these hookah pipes. In addition to just the harms of smoking hookah themselves, the air quality, these things produce a lot of smoke, and the smoke is in the air and hangs around. And again, we did some surveys as part of looking at compliance with the Indoor Clean Air Act, went to different hookah lounges and took some air sampling. And you can see that the hookah lounges, and this is a total of 10, but the hookah lounges that were visited ranged from the air quality, from being unhealthy, that was four of them, where everyone experiences, may begin to experience some health effects, and people with sensitive, you know, who might have asthma or things like that may have more serious, to the very unhealthy, which we would say a health alert, may have more serious health problems, to the hazardous. There was one in this category where the entire population is likely to be affected by smelling the smoke. So the air quality in these places is very poor as well. The customers of the hookah lounge are young, less than 25 years old, primarily. And here's a quote. One of the things that we've done also is to look at different social media, whether it be Facebook pages or those kinds of things. And these are advertised really in social media as well as websites, etc. So the quote, tired of not being able to go out and dance or hang with your friends since most places won't let you in because you're not 21 and up? Well, head over to our lounge and smoke some shisha. So again, these are being sold as a safe place for older teens and young adults. They are located in areas where there are a lot of youth. Portland metropolitan area has a large youth and young adult population. You can see both Lane and Benton counties, of course, are where Oregon State and University of Oregon are located. So looking at
just a minute. Doctor, I'm just curious to get back to the last slide. How did you determine that seems to be the highest locations in those counties right there?
Madam Chair and Representative Olson, so what we did is to look, we have these hookah lounges which need to be certified, and ones that have asked us to certify, we know the location of those. So hookah lounges have not yet opened up in every county throughout the state. These are where the hookah lounges that have either been certified or asked for certification. There's a total of 22 now, I think, or maybe there's even 23, another one, but this is where those hookah lounges have opened up or are seeking to open up.
Thank you.
So it really does make a difference whether or not these hookah lounges are in a county. The top line, so this compares hookah use in counties with and without hookah lounges. So the very top line there shows 11th grade hookah use in those counties that I just showed you that have a hookah lounge. The dashed, second dashed line is much lower again, and that's 11th grade use in the counties that do not have these lounges. The two bottom lines are for eighth graders. Again, the use overall is less among eighth graders, but you can see the solid line for the eighth graders is in counties with hookah lounges, and then the dashed line in those counties that do not have hookah lounges. This compares what's happening with boys and girls. It appears that hookah is particularly appealing to young women. So again, the two lines here, the top ones have hookah use among 11th grade, the one that's increasing so sharply, and I'm sorry about these colors, but that's 11th grade use by girls in those counties with hookah lounges. The top, the other line that's cross-sectioning it is boys in those counties with hookah, and then the two lines at the bottom are hookah use, the top one among girls and the second one among boys, but in counties that do not have hookah lounges. So to summarize, hookah lounges promote tobacco use among youth and young adults, and where we're seeing a lot of the increase in tobacco use is in hookah use, and particularly in those counties where hookah lounges are located. It appears to be fastest growing among girls, and they are getting certified under the smoke shop exemption for the Indoor Clean Air Act. So I'll switch gears just slightly to sampling ban and then take questions if that's okay. So free samples of tobacco product. Again, this is a way that tobacco companies, it's a strategy that they use to have youth and young adults try tobacco for the first time. And again, nicotine extremely addictive once people become regular users. The Centers for Disease Control recommends that banning sampling is an effective way to keep tobacco product out of the hands of kids. So it turns out that federal law prohibits free samples of cigarettes, thankfully, but the federal law does not include sampling, or that you're allowed to give out sampling of smokeless tobacco products. Oregon law does allow free samples in adult-only venues, but these samples get into hands of kids. And an adult-only venue is sometimes seen at, for example, the bottom, that it's frequently given out at rodeos or fairs or whatever, and they may have a tent that's labeled adults only, but again, they may not be carting people at the door or whatever. So it's clear that in a fair setting, or if you go there, if the 17-year-old is going there or 16 with their 18-year-old friend, the 18-year-old can get the sample and then come out and give that to the younger kids. In 2004, Pendleton passed an ordinance that implemented a ban on distributing tobacco products. And, of course, the Pendleton Rodeo was a place that many of these tobacco products had been given out in the past. And the ban has significantly decreased the access that youth in that community have to the free tobacco products during the time of the rodeo. So a stronger statewide sampling ban would help to keep tobacco out of the hands of youth. So I end with this, you know, how mild can a cigarette get? More doctors smoke camels. Again, this is an old ad, but I think we've come a long way, although we're not quite there yet when it comes with the problems of tobacco use. As I'd mentioned already, it continues to be the leading cause of preventable death in Oregon and in the rest of the United States. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Hedberg. Any questions? Representative Freeman, good to see you.
Good morning. Sorry I was late. I had the opportunity in September to spend a few weeks in Turkey, and as you might imagine, this is very common there. But my question is there any studies, or have you looked at any of the cultural connections to those particular counties or people that seem to be using this or the increase in use?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Freeman, it turns out that the use of hookah, as you mentioned, there are cultural connotations in some of the countries, particularly in the Middle East, where people use these as kind of a social gathering. What's happened with hookah, this increase in use, has really been seen not just in the United States, not just in Oregon or the United States, but around the world. So it is a product that's being increasingly targeted to kids and youth, not just as part of a social use within the communities where it's been traditionally used, if you will, but much more broader. And so, you know, again, our concern is less that if there's a family who, as part of a tradition, may be using this in their home, but rather these hookah lounges that are very particularly trying to target youth in the communities as, you know, again, it looks exotic, and a number of the websites, I mean, you know, I showed the picture, they're advertising it as kind of an exotic, different product, not that it's being used in a in a cultural fashion.
And that is obviously a very young person who is in that picture. That's not someone.
Would you like to pass it around?
Yes.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I know that you mentioned this, but could you repeat again when somebody does, you know, like take a hit off a hookah or whatever, how much more tobacco it is in there as opposed to just smoking a cigarette? Because I think you mentioned how many cigarettes kind of like are in a session or whatever.
Right. So Madam Chair and Representative Dottery, it's not that a single puff is going to have a lot more. It's that during a session when people are sitting in this venue and the tobacco is being put on there and the people who are walking around are refilling the bowls and doing it. So the 100 cigarettes is in a full session, if you will, but you're spending the evening, let's say, from 8 until midnight or something sitting in this setting, smoking and being exposed to the secondhand smoke.
And it's like smoking 100 cigarettes.
So, you know, a number of the studies that have been done, again, in Oregon, we don't yet have data. I talked about the health effects because it hasn't been used all that long in our state. But there are lots of studies that come from both the Middle East as well as parts of India that are looking at the health effects, not only of the people who use them themselves, but pregnant women, for example. And again, it's tobacco, so the health effects that they're seeing are exactly the same as they would be from other tobacco products.
Thank you. Representative Dimbra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really, I appreciate the issue of, children being targeted or young people being targeted and the adverse effects on that. But I'm wondering if, is there any evidence that hookah use becomes a sort of gateway to regular cigarette use, in which case I think it would rise even higher in the concern. I mean, if someone is just occasionally using this as a recreational kind of thing, I'm not as concerned. But if there's real evidence that it's leading to increased cigarette use, where you're not place-bound, and that, I think, becomes a real concern. So have there been studies? Is there any evidence of that?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Dimbro, we looked at that specifically. The way we get our data is from our school-based surveys, and so it's what we call cross-sectional. We ask at the same time. It turns out that the majority of kids who report using hookah also are cigarette smokers, but because of the nature of the survey, we haven't asked the question, was your first sample of tobacco through hookah versus cigarettes? So we know these kids are taking tobacco products in a variety of settings. The other thing that we know is that in Portland a couple of years, maybe it was the last legislative session, I came and talked about the free samples of Orbs. These were smokeless tobacco products. Prior to that, the big thing for youth was clove cigarettes. So tobacco, because people are using less and less, that is adults, the prevalent goes down, they're looking for a variety of ways to get kids, young adults, interested in trying a variety of tobacco products and then again selling them and when people become addicted. So again, I appreciate your concern that this is hard to carry around in your back pocket. It's in that sense, people aren't going to be using it as much as they would cigarettes, but it turns out that the people who are using this are often, it's the same kids who are smoking cigarettes as well.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up. Thank you. So is that something that you could test for or add to your surveys, to try to find out, if the chicken came before the egg,
Yes, so,
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Dimbro, we certainly could. Our surveys are usually a year out or so we'd have to think about those questions for, I won't be able to have the answer for you in the next couple of months, unfortunately, but looking at that sort of time course of events. But again, what's happening now is that more and more of these hookah lounges are being asked for certification. And so one of the issues really is, people doing this in sort of a public venue that they're being exposed to this, to this product and going there as part of a social kind of norm and being exposed, as well as whether or not it starts them to, starts folks to be using tobacco for a lifetime. But we can certainly look at adding the question.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Well, the interesting thing is, for me, it all comes down to money. And how much could a kid afford to spend? And it says, on this one, it says $15 a hookah, two people per hookah, which means for $750 a night, you can smoke on a hookah. But now you're addicted to a drug, and you obviously have to continue to use in order to exacerbate the pain of withdrawal. So it would seem to me that this, even you're not going to go for hookah a lot, because I don't know what disposable income kids have anymore, but they're going to go to cigarettes because that's one way they can take care of their addiction. So my question, I don't know if there's an answer, but it certainly makes me think about how this begins the system of getting you addicted, and then you have to continue to find some way to feed that addiction.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Van Orman, I think that's exactly the point. That's why free samples are given out, because then people try them and they decide they like them. Again, there's not free sampling of hookah, but the smokeless tobacco products. The other thing that we see with cigarettes is reduced or coupons, if you will. So again, they're not allowed to sample them, but if you get reduced price, if you send off or whatever, again, these are ways to get people addicted to a product that they then become users. Or you don't get that directly, but you get yourself on a mailing list, and then you get direct mailings of reduced tobacco use that last for a short period of time, and then again, people become lifetime users. So,
and I have a follow-up.
Follow-up.
So then we know we tax cigarettes. So does the tobacco used in the hookah, does that face the same kind of taxation policy?
So, Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that.
Come on and forward.
It's taxed as a pipe tobacco.
Oh, okay. That's
which
right.
Is lesser
which
than
is
a cigarette?
A lot less. Yeah. It's a lot less.
I rest my case.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative, I'm really glad you asked that question. When I think of 100 cigarettes in one evening, that is
that's
just...
That's five packs of cigarettes
yeah,
in an evening.
Just,
it's made me sick.
Makes me breathless.
Well, Madam Chair, I do have a question.
Go.
Thank you. How many other states are dealing with this, having this kind of a problem right now?
So, Madam Chair.
Maybe not, I guess, really identify as a problem, but saying, obviously, their attention is directed toward this.
Madam Chair and Representative Olson, I know that a lot of states have dealt with this already. Maybe, do we know specifically which states have hookah?
Utah has dealt with it, but
So the state of Utah is dealing with it. Other states that have the Indoor Clean Air Act, again, there's, I think, two things, and that was brought up already. There is a new product that, you know, a house party, and how much do we want to intervene in what's happening in the household? You could say that's outside, but it's really these hookah lounges, which are public venues that seem to be getting through this exemption in the Indoor Clean Air Act, both in Oregon and other states. So Utah and other states that have strong exemptions or strong Indoor Clean Air Acts, because clearly not every state does.
Okay, thank you. Representative Brooks.
Quickly, so, Doctor, are you suggesting that we increase the standards for the hookah lounges? I mean, what's sort of the take-home that you're looking for from us?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Dembro, I think our understanding was that the intention with the Indoor Clean Air Act was to ban smoking in workplaces. And again, there are, you know, the people who are carrying around with both the charcoal and refilling the bowls, et cetera, tend to be young adults just as well, who are inhaling all of that secondhand smoke day after day. But the intention was to not allow that type of smoking in public places or work sites. The Indoor Clean Air Act study, and I think there are copies for all of you, when we looked at that indoor air quality in the cigar bars, the ones that have been grandfathered in or allowed to exist, the indoor air quality in them was much, much better. So, in fact, the cigar bars and those smoke shops that we mentioned where, again, the intention, I think, was the sampling of tobacco product that you would then take out was very different. So you know, so our feeling is that if actually the Indoor Clean Air Act were enforced to the intention that people thought, which is, again, the sampling of, or, you know, the scar bars that were grandfathered in, and specifically, or not allowing the sampling of product on site for the smoke shops would be helpful.
When we wrote this legislation, we hookah bars were very, very rare, so it was not included. We didn't anticipate that this was going to be a huge issue. So I think now we need to address this at this late date.
Madam Chair, if I could make one more comment about it. I think, you know, part of the ways we look at smoke shop has to do where the overall revenue comes from. And so if the revenue is coming from tobacco that is being purchased there and taken elsewhere, that may be part of the reason why coming to the hookah lounge is the actual price for an evening, as you said, two people sharing, you know, $15 is $7. That's less than going to a movie that, you know, then they're taking part. So they can fit under that. Not because the letter of the law, even though it doesn't appear that that was the intent of the law.
There will be legislation. I'm introducing legislation that will be dealing with this issue. So you will be seeing it. I'm not sure it'll be in this committee, but it will be, I know, it will be in some committee.
Good.
Thank you. Representative.
Real quick, and thank you. I appreciate it. You talked about there being 22 or 20 of these things that are either certified or asking for certification. And I'm sorry, I know nothing about this type of business, and you describe people carrying them around or working within those workplaces. Is there any idea of how many people per facility? Or, I mean, is there any kind of, I mean, is it two or three people or 10 people? I don't know how big these things are, I guess.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah, so Madam Chair and Representative Freeman, I think it varies. The pictures that I showed earlier of the places that it's used can be anything from a relatively large kind of club to a very small, intimate. So obviously, the smaller, more intimate lounge would have fewer workers that would be exposed compared to the very large, sort of more...
Actually, I'm aware of a large lounge that is in the process of being opened. That would have quite a few.
All right, well, maybe we have more of that talk when the legislation comes through. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative.
Well, and I think one thing to look at, I live very close to a high school, and until the Clean Air Act went in, there was a hookah bar within walking distance of the high school and a pizza parlor where the kids go for lunch. And not only that, there is a hookah bar which is within, right in the city of Tigard, which is also fairly close to the high school and fairly close to a middle school. So I don't know if there's any consideration as to, you know, actually where these places are, because it was a definite target for the high school kids to have a hookah facility really close to the high school. So.
And we need to close this, friends, because our time is up and we've got a big agenda. But thank you very much for this information. Thank you, Dr. Hedberg. Thanks for all who brought this information to us. And we will be having a bill in the future. Thank you very much. Now we're having another informational meeting, General Assistance, a pilot project with John Mullen. John, it's good to see you again. What do we need?
You did that one-page thing on it.
It's
flavors on it.
Oh, the photo? I've got it. Does she need that back?
Yes.
Dr. Hedberg, may I hold it? May I keep this? Or do you need it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, that's fine. We can get it.
Okay, thank you.
Unfortunately.
Yes, I'm sure. Okay. Are we ready to go, committee? All right. Terrific. John, good to see you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. First of all, I just want to say I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about general assistance this morning. I have a very brief update that I would like to give to the committee. I also want to acknowledge that a couple of members of the committee won't be back next time around, but also for a number of you, this may seem like deja vu. We were talking about this back in 2007 and also in 2009. One of the reasons for coming back during a time of great challenge, next session will bring a $3.5 billion deficit to start out. And it is a daunting kind of an issue for me, let alone what you have to deal with, to come before you and say there's a program that needs to be looked at and thought about and perhaps redesign some and look off into the future. One of the things that we've talked about when we've been before the committee committee is about the history of the General Assistance Program. I really won't take the committee's time to go over that because I think it's really well known. But basically, one of the things that I do want to say about the General Assistance Program, which has not been funded since 2005, is that conceptually, at least when I think about it, we have a number of pillars in our society, structures in a sense that deal with issues when people are not in the workforce. And they're really very well known to the general public. We think about unemployment insurance. We think about somebody injured on the job, workers' compensation. We think about long-term disability benefits. We think about temporary assistance for needy families that help people when they can't be in the workforce for a variety of reasons. Along the way, due to budget cuts, we lost the General Assistance Program, which was one of those safeguards for very low-income people. And as committee members, you've heard me talk about the poorest of the poor, because the people who were eligible for General Assistance are people unable to work for a year or better, no more than $1,500 in assets, $50 of which was in cash. So these were people that were really having lots of difficulties. The tragedy of the loss of the General Assistance Program is that even though the program funding went away, obviously the need did not go away. And we see people in communities all around the state that are struggling with figuring out how to deal with issues that sometimes are beyond their capacity to solve on their own. So we have been working with a coalition of different organizations, and I'm sorry that I don't have the updated coalition list with me here today. But in fact, we do need to revise and take another look at our coalition and think about how we will approach this, working with all of you in the next session. The concept that we have talked about a pilot, which is in the papers that I've submitted to you today, was basically recognizing where we are currently with the budget challenges that we are and trying to look across systems about what would be the best way to approach general assistance in the era that we're in now. I just want to be clear that our General Assistance Coalition has as its ultimate goal to see the restoration of a full general assistance program, but due to the cost and other challenges that the legislature will face, our coalition didn't feel that it would be prudent to come back with a discussion about restoring the full general assistance program. Based on experience that I had in Clackamas County when I was director of Clackamas County Social Services, when the General Assistance Program went away, we got a grant from the Social Security Administration that was short-term, but we were able to work with people in our community to help them get disability benefits, long-term disability benefits. And one of the principal areas that we worked with were people coming out of the county jails. If you think again about the population, you think about the folks that are suffering from mental health issues, very often physical disabilities and substance abuse issues at times, people that don't fit very well into the society and don't have very many options for where they're going to be housed, often wind up circulating in and out of county jails. Well, the same is true about people being in the prison system. One of the things that the legislature did back in 2005 was pass Senate Bill 913, which did an interesting kind of thing. First of all, it said that people that are in prison can't be receiving Medicaid benefits. But it also recognized the fact that there needed to be some work done about the people who were being released from prison to make sure that they were getting the eligibility work done for benefits that they that would help them to be self-sufficient. And there's been some very good work done by the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections. And one of the things that I have personally learned, spending a fair amount of time with, particularly with the Department of Corrections, is learning a little bit more about the systems that they've had in place. And they have been very cooperative in helping with a lot of information and a lot of different looks at how we might work a pilot program. And the pilot program, which is described in the paper, is actually a very small pilot. The problem is that we don't yet have a clear idea about the numbers that we're talking about, and it's simply because the Department of Corrections and the the Department of Human Services, even though they're working together, they keep records and information in different systems, and there are a variety of follow-up pieces that would be necessary to really hone in on how many people we would be talking about and what the cost would be. There are people that get out of the prison system that have not fully been put on the path of getting disability benefits, those that might be eligible. That's a population that we would like to work with. There are also those people that have qualified for disability benefits, but there's a gap in time when they would get their first payment. And we just know that it's critical to people's success in staying out of the prison system to be able to get the support they need when they need it immediately after getting out of prison. So basically, what the General Assistance Program had was three basic components, which would still be in place, but for a much smaller population with this pilot concept. One is access to the Oregon Health Plan plus benefits. The second is a $314 a month dollar grant, which is what the grant was initially, what it was last in 2005. And then the strong case management function to help those people become eligible for long-term federal disability benefits, which would help to make sure that people can live self-sufficiently in the community. The pilot itself, which is described and is taking shape, basically would be something, as I mentioned earlier, where we need to hone in and get a little bit more information on the numbers of people and the dollars that are involved. But I really want to circle back to something that the committee did in the 2009 session, which is already very helpful. Representative Freeman and Representative Dembro worked with a couple of us on a work group, and we basically revised in that bill what the General Assistance Program really is all about. The statute itself is very, very vague, the current statute, because it goes back to the Depression era, and it was trying to deal with a myriad of issues and people that needed assistance. So what we have as a baseline, in any event, is the good work that was done by the two members of your committee, Madam Chair, as the baseline for saying, here's what the General Assistance Program should look like. What my hope is that we can see the bill introduced, and I've worked with you, Madam Chair, on a bill draft, which basically takes House Bill 2051A from the 2009 session. It's basically the same bill, and that we would hopefully have an opportunity to come before this committee and also look at having a work group that gets the people from the Department of Corrections, DHS, and advocates together to talk about what would be possible. Now, when I say this committee, of course, I recognize the fact that, as I mentioned, two of members who I've grown to know over the years that won't be back in next session. Also, we, of course, don't know what the membership of this committee will be made up, how it will be made up, and how it will be chaired, and so forth. So I do, in fact, though, hope to see this bill referred to the successor committee, to this committee, because it is essentially starts out as a human service program, even though it has that components of working with people in the prison system. And ultimately, we also hope that we can work with a couple of local county jails. So basically, Madam Chair and members of the committee, what I'm really here to do today, and I'll end here and see what questions there might be, is basically, once again, to thank you for your involvement over the last number of sessions. I recognize this may feel a little bit like deja vu to see me again talking about general assistance, but it's basically because this is a gap in society that we continually want to talk about ways in which we can address this. And hopefully we will get some really smart people together in the next session and talk about how we can do something that will help get us on the path to getting this program back in place. The final thing that I would just mention in passing is that we're challenged with working across systems, and this is something that the incoming governor talks a fair amount, but also in the discussion that Representative Maurer and others have had on the whole healthcare discussion, We talk about bending the cost curve in healthcare. We also need to look at bending the cost curve in corrections and also make sure that our human services programs are running as efficiently as possible. And in my way of thinking is that if we can get something started with a pilot and move ultimately to have a general assistance program that runs efficiently, effectively, and takes care of a pressing need that while we don't have the program in place and the dollars are not spent in that program, it costs in prison systems and mental health systems and a whole variety of other systems cost shifts to other programs and to other problems in the local community that go unsolved. And so with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would just like to say thank you for the opportunity today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. Representative Freeman and Representative Timbo, thank you so much for working on this issue. It's a tough one we've been working on for many years. Yeah. Any questions? All right. Thank you. I'm sure we're going to be seeing you again, John.
Yes. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Now we're going to have an update on the statewide children's wraparound initiative. I think I see Aaron. Did Aaron come in? Bill Buska. And I don't know who else.
She was here.
Yeah, I know. Her. I saw her.
Don't those smoke shops, don't they have to, don't you have to be 18?
Yeah,
I think that I was reading them.
Yeah.
I would think they're like a
little
C store.
Had a good, great style for dealing with
everybody. Hello.
Who's with on your side?
Good morning.
Good morning. We're glad you're here.
Thank you for having us, Chair Tomei. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. I am the Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division for the Department of Human Services. And I was asked to come before you this morning to give you a brief, very brief, we will do our best, very brief update on implementation of House Bill 2144. The bill, actually, this committee played a very significant role in last legislative session that charged multiple state agencies to create a coordinated system of care for children with behavioral health issues. We in Oregon have nicknamed this initiative the Wraparound Initiative, and so I'm briefly going to give you from an agency perspective what's happened in the past year and a half in terms of our efforts to implement this bill. And also with me is Cynthia Jackson. She is a family member who is going to speak to you about her perspective on what Wraparound brings for her family and her children. And also Lacey Andreessen, who is with who is a child welfare supervisor here in Marion Polk Yamhill Counties. And she's going to share with you perspective on what this does for kids in foster care and for our system as it relates to implementation of the legislation. Just want to remind quickly the initiative goals. If you remember, this really was about better integrating and coordinating services for kids, recognizing that in the lives of children, many state agencies are often involved. And the idea with this legislation was to charge all of those state agencies to better coordinate resources, better coordinate their planning efforts, and really streamline things from the perspective of the child, family, and also from agencies and a regulatory perspective. And one of the culture shifts that this is requiring of us is that this is a family and youth-driven conversation. So when we're making plans or when we're coordinating resources or coordinating services, that family and youth perspective on what they need and what they want is front and center at the table. We had quite a few jobs in front of us when DHS actually was appointed the lead agency in this effort by the legislation. And we have been working around several different areas to implement this. We have created project sites that we are piloting and implementing as we speak. I'll talk a little more about that. We've been developing a set of indicators and outcomes metrics that we can baseline now and then tell you what the initiative actually is able to accomplish for us as we move forward. Workforce development and that culture change, training around what it is we're asking, and in the different systems, sometimes asking them to be family and youth driven is quite a change from where they're accustomed to approaching the work. And so workforce development has been a focus. Coordination of our information and data is important if we're going to be data driven and we're going to provide real-time service access and delivery to families. Financing and federal policy almost are interchangeable, trying to figure out how do we braid or blend the federal funds that currently support these young people that are very inflexible and have many, many requirements attached to them. We've had a cross-agency department and division transformation team, so this is wrapped up in a continuous improvement effort for DHS so that we can streamline things through this process and make sure that we're going about it in a way that eliminates work that isn't adding value. We have an interagency steering team, and then we've been using the Children's Wraparound Initiative. We have an advisory committee that's comprised of family members, all the state agencies, providers, et cetera, who are advising us as we go forward.
And I'm going to stop you for a second. I was very interested in what you said about the information system. Can you talk just briefly about that? I guess I've heard some concerns and around the building about how difficult sometimes it is to share information among the agencies and also with the nonprofits, hospitals, etc. Can you talk just briefly about that?
Of course, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. So this is a big issue. It's been a surprise to me since assuming this position how behind many of our how behind our infrastructure is at our state agencies with respect to data collection and technology. I think you know we've mentioned in this group before we're implementing new technology just in the next 2 months in child welfare. We call it the ORCID system, and one of the requirements of that system was that it have the ability to interface with other systems in a way that was more seamless. So with the courts and other people who need information, even providers in mental health and healthcare. But it's taking us a long time because it requires investment in new technology to really capture the benefit of what is available today technologically for data sharing and data information. There are several different big moving pieces that I think are going to make a big difference for the state along these lines. Child welfare and the courts are moving to an electronic data system. We are in the process of developing what we're calling a modernization effort in DHS around our eligibility work and how we collect and share data and information across programs throughout the agency. The health reform effort and the health information technology effort that's driving us toward a centralized exchange and electronic health records and data keeping, all of these things are now, all of these offer projects and initiatives are now talking to one another about how to overcome the challenges you're describing so that when we build new systems, they can better communicate, better interface. It's going to take us a while to get there, but I think we're on the right track.
Great. Thank you.
So to begin with, if you recall, this legislation was passed without any funding to support it. And so what the agency did was identify a priority population to get us started. What we honed in on to begin with, looking at the identified population in the bill, which you have outlined here, for phase one, we've identified children in DHS custody, which really means children who are in foster care for whom the state has legal responsibility, who've been there more than 1 year and who have had at least 4 placements. Alternatively, children who would qualify in phase one are children in the custody of DHS, who have severe enough conditions to warrant direct entry because they would have to go straight to a high level of care. So we have some kids who come into our system who haven't been there very long, but they're coming in because they have very significant behavioral health needs. We realize this is a much smaller cohort than the population that the bill assigned for the future vision around what this could mean in terms of a coordinated system of care, but we decided to start with this population group because they tend to be the highest end users of service that cost the state the most. And our theory has been that if we can make a difference for those kids, we can surely make a difference for the kids around prevention, early intervention, and maybe even have some resource to reinvest in those more front-end preventive, early interventive services, because the children at the high end are costing the state a bit less because we're serving them better, serving their families better. The projects that we've initiated, I'm going to just actually go one ahead, just so you, or a couple ahead, and then I'll go back. We have three project sites. We had, I believe it was 28 of the 36 counties in one form or fashion applied to be pilot sites for the phase one of the wraparound initiative. We knew the number of children specifically that we could undertake in the first phase, and after reviewing seriously with an advisory group those applications, we decided on these three project sites to begin with. One is in Washington County. We have a Mid-Valley WRAP project that is a multi-county effort, and then Rogue Valley also is two counties down in Southern Oregon. So those are the counties that are currently involved in what I'm about to describe a bit more. The projects were tasked to include and involve local and state governance. There was to be a local single point of accountability, high fidelity to the wraparound process. One of the major requirements and efforts around the project is this issue of care coordination across multiple systems. And then, of course, we're tracking their outcomes to see how effective this actually is. These are the outcomes. There were many. We literally have pages and pages of multi-system outcomes. One of the best things about this, from my view, is it's really challenging the agencies to have a family-centered, child-centered look at what's going on in the life of this kid beyond themselves. So each of us is always, I think, believing ourselves to be child and family-centered, but usually we do that through the lens of our particular mission. So in child welfare, it's about safety, protection, wellness, and kind of returning home. And so what this initiative is really challenging us to do is to also be mindful of what's going on in the mental health of that child. Are they doing better in school? And schools then also have to be mindful of, is the child safe? Is the child's placement stable? So we had a myriad of outcomes. We actually inventoried all the state agency outcomes that they currently are looking at and think are most important, and we had to narrow our focus for metrics development, and we chose these to be the key indicators of whether we're being successful or not in the life of this child and family because of this coordination effort. So I really want to get to our other two presenters here, and I just wanted to kind of share with you what's coming up next.
Doing fine, Erin, you don't need
to. I'm hopeful that we'll have a chance again to present. One of the tasks in the bill was to give you a five-year plan. How would we implement this coordinated system of care statewide within the 5 years coming straight after 2009, so by 2014. We've been working on developing that plan for you and really trying to interweave in it all of these components that I've been talking about this morning. We've also been, as part of that process, looking at a couple of different challenges and opportunities that I just want to leave you with. One of the challenges I wanted to highlight was the challenge around the information systems. I think, you know, they're on a path and they have a path and a schedule that I'm still learning about in terms of what's practical and possible around data and technology, and I think that that's a real issue for us, both in terms of real-time access on the ground for families and systems to know, you know, is there a vacancy over here that this child could benefit from in this program, all the way up to that aggregate data collection effort that we're making to share and coordinate around outcomes at the state level. One of the other challenges, of course, is resources. And when I say that, I mean really two primary ones. Of course, you know, there isn't new money that the system has available to it right now. So what we've been really focused on is how do we spend the money we have more effectively. And it always tends to come back to the federal folks needing to get on board with this concept and support us in having more flexibility around our funding and our spending. And we're working on trying to develop a plan for you, for the next governor, so that we can show what it would actually take to get there and, you know, incrementally. The other resource issue that is real right now is a staffing issue. To be participating in a lot of in these conversations requires staff time and staff effort to coordinate. And right now, for all of these systems, we're understaffed. We're all in hiring freezes or layoffs, and it's just been really difficult, I think, although a priority for everybody, to continue to do both their day job of in Ms. Andreessen's case, for example, of protecting kids and supervising workers, and then also be part of this coordinated effort. And I know everyone's doing that the best they can, but we get regular status reports from the project sites, and every time they mention the issues around staffing and how challenging it is sometimes for people to make the meetings and be part of the effort. The opportunities that I think are there, the good news, one of the things we've been doing as part of this report is to do an inventory for you of all the ongoing efforts in each of the agencies that relate back to this particular effort. And the good news is there is great alignment and synergy happening around the goals for this effort and for kids and for families. And so whether you look at the youth authority, child welfare, the DD system, education, there are opportunities that we've identified for alignment. I talk a lot with this group about the safe and equitable reduction of foster care. The Oregon Youth Authority and DHS are talking about crossover kids between delinquency and dependency. Some of the issues that the schools are grappling with around positive behavioral intervention and support, that's totally consistent with wraparound. The early childhood initiative and home visitation effort that's going on through the commission and the public health divisions are very consistent with this. I could go on and on. So that's the biggest opportunity I see is that what this is really trying to do, I think, is help us identify those priority outcomes and giving us tools to implement those and to share ownership for achieving them. So I appreciate the opportunity to catch you up on where we've been this last year and a half. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Jackson to share with you a little bit her perspective as a family member.
Great. I'm going to take a quick chance for anybody if they have any questions for Erin before we move on. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei and committee. My name is Cynthia Jackson, and I'm an adoptive parent. My husband and I have adopted twice through DHS, and we're receiving wraparound services at this time for our youngest two children. Our younger son, who we adopted a year and a half ago, came in and turned our house and life completely upside down with his disruptive behaviors and aggressive behaviors, and it's hard to describe for you. I mean, it's like taking a train and just throwing it off the track completely.
And how old is he?
He was 5 and a half when he came.
Thank you.
Kind of a junior Rambo.
Junior Rambo.
And so we've just thoroughly enjoyed and felt blessed to have the services of wraparound. They came in after we had been trying to access services for him and help for him through the school or through counselors that we would find and things like that. We were referred by our DHS worker to wraparound, and very quickly people started coming and introducing themselves to us. Our team was formed, and we were together planning how to serve him. It took a lot of people that were working separately, all in his interest, and organized it and made it much more efficient. And we got more bang for the buck for every part of what he was getting. But while they were doing all that, we stayed in the driver's seat. I mean, we've always been the ones that get to say what we feel we need and what we want. And they help us get that in a really efficient way. But they also bring new ideas to us that we might not have thought of. And so that, you know, by doing that, we've been able to keep him home a lot longer than we would have been able to if we hadn't had some of the ideas and supports that were brought to us. And you were talking about information, and I wanted to mention that all the information gets shared about our son because we meet together with all the different people that are helping him. And also, kind of behind the scenes, sometimes I walk into a meeting and our facilitator, our family support partner, have already shared a lot of information with the team about our family so that I don't have to repeat it over and over again. Because when you have a child that uses a lot of different services, you get to be really redundant on that kind of stuff. And I really enjoyed going to the care coordination committee part of wraparound, because there we had people from a lot of different agencies that weren't directly serving my son, but they were able to throw out ideas too as we made requests for certain services. They made suggestions about assessments that could be got for him or different ways of serving him that might be helpful. So there were just a lot of different brains brought together into one place for him. I think New Solutions has been an excellent bridge for us between the different services. He's gone from living in our home and receiving services in the community to day treatment all the way up to the level of residential care at this point. And as we've been introduced to each new school or treatment center, our partners, our support partner has been there, or our facilitator, to introduce us to the people that were going to be serving him. And it was a great bridge because she knows both sides. She knows where we're coming from. She knows what they have to offer and how their system works. And so it's not, we're not just walking in cold. It feels a lot better that way. And I think that we get a lot more, we get better results that way as well. I mentioned that we kept him home for a long time and provided services for him in the home rather than sending him right off to residential. And that was really, really important for him because he'd already been moved a lot of times and has started to not trust relationships and people or trust his position in any family. And so by being able to serve him in the community longer, we were able to give him time to build a bond with us and to have experiences that he would miss once he went to residential care. And that's important because now that he's there, he can know that there's something he's working to get back to. Otherwise, he may have just decided to give up on people altogether, and then we'd be serving him at McLaren or somewhere like that throughout his life. The New Solutions team has helped us to recognize, and they're helping us to put into place supports outside of the formal system, such as extended family or community support, so that when they eventually start to transition away from us or us from them, we'll be ready and we'll be able to keep going and stay strong. I mentioned in my written part that, you know, my husband and I are both educated and we're both skilled parents, but when we were hit with this crisis in our life, it became hard to do just the daily living tasks that we needed to do, let alone try to figure out where to get services for our son or what to do with him next. And having the wraparound come in was kind of like bringing in a management team for us to get us to the places where we needed to be while we just kept trying to survive. So I'm also an educator, and as I've experienced this model, I've felt like I wish that we could have a model like this for all of our special needs students in school. You know, we see them just from the education side. We're trying to make them successful throughout their day with their behavior and make sure that they're learning. But we don't have the connection to what's going on outside of school with them a lot of the time. And this type of process really pulls together all of the people that are working with a child and could really maximize the effectiveness of the services that each person is providing. So,
thank you so much. Your children are very lucky.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Committee, good morning. Lacey Andreessen with Department of Human Services, Child Welfare. I'm a supervisor to a unit of caseworkers who carries all teens in foster care. I wanted to share with you one story of a young man who is being served by the initiative now, and then would be happy to answer any more general questions if you have them. This young man has been in our care since he's 8. He's 13 today. He came to us out of a disrupted guardianship relative placement, and in the first 4 years that he was in the custody of the agency, he cycled through the highest levels of care multiple times. A year ago, a child and family team was formed for him, and along with his caseworker and his RAP facilitator, the school system is represented on his team. His counselor has stayed consistent. He has a mentor, and his mom was released from prison. She has become an active member of his team as well. When he was last placed in residential treatment at Christie Care a year ago, his team started planning immediately for what his aftercare plan should look like and started looking at resources in the community that would best meet his treatment needs based on what the very skilled professionals at Christie Care told them. He stepped down out of Christie 6 months ago and has been in the same treatment foster care home since then. It's the longest that he has stabilized in our care in the last 5 years. He has therapeutic visits with his mom. She probably will never be a placement resource for him, but he's able to see her in a very nurturing and very healthy setting for him. And his team and the doctors and counselors who work with him
credit that rebuilt relationship as probably something that's been a success for him. And so, you know, it's just one example of a kiddo who we've struggled with for years, and when all of the different agencies that touch this one child's life, he has 11 adults on his child and family team who meet monthly, and it seems to be that there's really already been some positive outcomes for him.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions of any of these witnesses? Did I see a hand? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair. Aaron, can you help me understand, are there additional people that are required to come in? You talk about staffing, and, you know, we've heard a number of presentations on wraparound the last couple of years. Where's the problem with staffing? Because it seems like that the 13-year-old today, you know, has certain people in his life and has providing services over time, and we have departments that provide these services. I guess I've always struggled to figure out why we have a problem and why we need more people and more budget to have these people come in and do the right thing.
Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, there are really two issues as I see it, and I don't know if Lacey might want to speak to this since she's the one who has to also navigate this on the ground, but I think one of the challenges as we become more and more short-staffed, I'll speak from the child welfare perspective since we're really one of the focus areas right now. Our staffing levels in child welfare right now are lower than they've ever been, and so we have caseworkers carrying more cases than they've ever had to carry. So they have many, as part of that work, they have many responsibilities. Yes, serving these children is the responsibility, but I think as they're serving more and more children, carving out the time once a month per child, when they have, you know, they can have upwards of 20-plus children on their caseload, plus making their monthly visits to their children, monthly visits to their parents, all the documentation and paperwork. It can feel, I think, sometimes like an add-on. One of the things I've heard from staff is that it ends up creating efficiency for them moving forward because they can all come together and coordinate at one time. So I think when people get into the rhythm of this is the new way of doing the work, and they see the benefit of it to their day-to-day, sort of the efficiency around how to case plan for that child, how to meet the needs of that parent and child, how to connect with the foster parent, it actually becomes something that they look forward to and that they're more than willing to carve the time out for. But I think as our staff just become more and more stretched, it's just that tension between what we know is kind of can sometimes putting in that little front end of time to save time down the road versus managing the crisis of the day. So that's just kind of one perspective on it. The other thing that happens in this process is that there is additional staff associated as care coordinators. The idea is to have someone who is neutral, who's not associated with the systems, who's sitting at the table kind of pushing back, challenging the system, to hear the voice of the parent, to give additional resource, to coordinate better, to make the phone calls to say, we've got this meeting, you need to show up. And so that is an additional staffing resource, somebody to pull all of the 8 or 11 agencies that are part of a child's life to say, this is when we're meeting, and this is what you're expected to bring. And then here's what everybody agreed to do going out of the meeting, and making sure people follow up on that and there's activity since the meeting after.
Thanks.
Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm. So in the end, it seems like time and money will be saved, but at the beginning it's going to take more resources to put this kind of team together. Is that sort of what I'm hearing? I'm hearing you, Mom, say that you're trying to keep this child out of going to McLaren later on, but right now it's taking a lot of resources to get him healthy enough so that he doesn't end up in the criminal justice system later. Am I correct in making that summation?
I think that's true. And as I mentioned, as an educator, I see families in our school system where the parents don't have the skills to advocate for their children or to even realize they need services or the skills to make the appointments that are made for them. And the wraparound facilitator, again, kind of holds people accountable and makes sure those things keep happening, which for all kids is going to lead to better success earlier and keep them out of more expensive systems later.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of flesh out the picture for me, Ms. Jackson, you know, you talked about the New Solutions program, and it sounds great. Who are the members of the wraparound team, specifically? And, some of them are from state agencies, others are school, and are there county and local? So what would a typical team look like?
Well, a team is made according to the family's desires and needs. Of course, we have our wraparound facilitator and a family support partner. And then it really depends on what the child needs. In our case, we've involved his special education teacher, his counselor, his DHS worker. He has actually a couple. We have an adoption worker, and he has his worker that he had before. So they're both part of the team. And as he gains new services, then the people that are providing those often join the team too. It's kind of changed a little bit. Sometimes some people come in for a while and go out for a while, depending on where he is. Like right now, because he's in residential, we're not including our community school staff. Although I keep them updated, they're not coming to the regular meetings. But for a while, we actually were meeting at school so that his special ed teacher and school counselor could be part of it, as well as the counselor we had on the outside.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you. I apologize for coming in the middle of your testimony, but in reading what you've said and listening to you, I'd just like to comment that so much of what you're talking about is Head Start, supporting the family, getting the services for families, making sure that those connections are made. And so, again, your experience justifies why we need a preschool program like Head Start with comprehensive services.
Well heard, Representative.
Can I respond to that? He was in Head Start, and I think Head Start is really important, but for him that wasn't enough.
That's right.
Before he was placed with us, he was in a Head Start classroom throwing the furniture and doing what he wanted to do. He really needed a whole team around him to address all of his needs.
Thank you. One last question? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Jackson, you don't have to answer for privacy or whatever. Would you mind giving us an idea of what your son's difficulties are, what his diagnosis is, so that we can, because there could be a whole range of problems.
Well, there's a new diagnosis coming, and that's what's really going to fit him. I hope it comes out, called developmental trauma disorder, if it makes it into the DSM-5. That isn't official yet, so he gets labels like post-traumatic stress disorder, oppositional defiance disorder, anxiety disorder, mood disorder. He gets diagnoses like that. But what it all comes from is being exposed to a lot of trauma during his developmental years. First in his birth home through the substance abuse, actually in utero substance abuse, and then being exposed to that in the home and domestic violence, and then multiple moves, all have caused him to see the world as kind of an enemy and that he needs to be in charge of it. So the way he deals with life is to raise his fist very quickly or throw a chair or scream and kick and totally disrupt whatever activity is going on. When he's at school, he refuses usually to follow the directions or the routines in the classroom. He does what he wants to do and runs away or throws a tantrum or becomes aggressive if that's not what is allowed.
Okay. Thank you.
Best of luck to you and your family. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron. We're going to be moving on to public guardianship, conservatorship, task force findings, and recommendations. Representative Denver, are you going to stay up here or are you going to go down there?
No, I'll go down there, but we're missing still. Here comes one. So.
Okay, good.
So we can get started.
Great, good.
Did
you bring it?
Yeah, I hear that. Just tried to use the restroom while I'm coming. They're like, I'm going to get back. They didn't go to the restroom with me. They walked down there to me. They stopped at the door like, yeah, I got this.
October.
Oh, yeah.
Get a little bit more.
Give them a Christmas gift. Yeah.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Good morning.
So proceed.
Hello.
Hello. And you are?
Thank you, Madam Chair, honorable colleagues. I'm Michael Dembro, State Representative for House District 45, Northeast Portland, Park Rose, and that city within a city of Maywood Park. It's my pleasure to bring to you a panel of representatives from the Public Guardianship Conservatorship Task Force, and I'm just going to be kind of kicking things off. But I will say that this topic of Oregon's need for public guardianship and conservatorship is something that this committee heard about back in 2009 through the vehicle of House Bill 2883, which we passed out of this committee, and it was passed by the legislature as a whole. And what it did was to create a task force to examine the need in this state for services for, well, you've already heard the term the neediest of the needy, and this is a group that really falls into that category. People in need of guardianship services who are indigent, they don't have the means to provide those services out of their own means or their estate, and they have need for it. And you're going to hear a kind of review of what is meant by public guardianship in a couple of situations. I have with me Jeff Brandon, who is he's currently with the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, but his background is doing public guardianship work through Multnomah County. And he'll share with you just a couple of case histories of examples of who falls into this category and you know what their needs are. Marcy Ingledew from the ARC of Oregon will be coming and talking about a couple of cases in which people who are in need of people who have developmental disabilities and who need these services. And Margie Carley is going to talk about the recommendations of the task force. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jeff just to explain to us a little bit about people who need public guardianship services.
Right. Hello. I'm happy to be here this morning.
Jeff, could you give us your name, please, for the
okay.
record?
Yes, Jeff Brandon. And I do belong to the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, which this morning just happens to be meeting at the library, so very convenient for me to walk over here. And I'm also on this task force, the Public Guardian and Conservator Task Force. And I retired from my job as Deputy Public Guardian of Multnomah County in 2003. I had worked there since 1978, so 25 years of being a public guardian. So any questions you have, you know, I think I probably know the answer. My case that I handed out to you this morning is just a real brief example of what goes on there. Now, a little background, the Public Guardian program was created by the legislature in 1971, and Multnomah County quickly adopted it in 72. So almost 40 years of existence. And again, as you've heard, and you probably remember, it's an enabling statute, 125.700 ORS, that other counties over the last 40 years just did not adopt. And they could, but you know, getting a serious social services legal program past a county commission is a tough thing to do. Jackson County has a little hybrid program that still exists, but Multnomah has the only full-time public guardian program. It's a 10-person staff, and the importance of it is that in the business of guardianship and conservatorship, It's a field for the private sector.
Jeff, I'm just going to stop just for a second.
Sure.
You have probably until about, the panel has until about 10 minutes after 10.
Be brief.
So I just...
Be brief. Okay. It's a field for the private sector. And the private sector, traditionally banks, but now people have gone in the private business of being a guardian conservator. They need to make money doing this. It's a capitalistic system. They need to make a profit. And that's what... But for people that need guardianship, and I'm talking about, you know, older people, mentally ill people, brain damaged people, whatever, if they don't have money, then you know, the private sector, the private guardians and conservators are not going to take that case. There's the niche for the public guardian, and that's why in Multnomah County, it's incredibly busy. And this case here is about a typical kind of case that comes up through law enforcement, where you read about this in the Oregonian about once a month, where, and I just reviewed with my colleague this case at the public guardian's office, where the 78-year-old man with advanced dementia owns a home in Northeast Portland, and his son had spent a lot of years in prison and got out of prison, moved in with his father, and just completely took over his assets and emptied his bank accounts and spent his pension checks and didn't take care of his father. And so Adult Protective Services, thank God for Adult Protective Services, became aware of this case through a neighbor. And so we got to do something. I mean, the son is controlling the situation. His father is in terrible health. He's been exploited by the son. I mean, these are tough cases. So this was a public guardian case, and they were able to get the man to the hospital, and he couldn't go back home. He was so sick. But then they had to deal with the son who would not cooperate. And, you know, it was a major intervention with the help of law enforcement in Multnomah County and the public guardian. So what I want to tell you is that the public guardian is an integral part of the social, legal, medical fabric of Multnomah County and Portland. And it needs to be part of the fabric in the other counties and in the rest of the state. So that's my basic message.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. I'm Margaret Murphy Carley, otherwise known as Margie. I retired from Oregon Healthcare Association in 2007. I do some work for the Center for Ethics and Healthcare and serve on several boards, commissions, and task force. I wanted to recognize the wonderful work that Representative Michael Dembro has done in supporting our committee throughout its 15 months of work. In addition, Senator Mona Anderson has also participated in some of our task force meetings. And a special thanks to our chair, Judge Betsy Welch, who couldn't be here today because she's in court. We do have some task force members as well as some of the public who regularly attended our meetings, including Kelly Bershears from the ODVA, because she runs a small guardianship program for veterans in Oregon. We'd like to thank them. And all of the supplies and services were donated because this was a no money attached task force. And so we want to thank again Oregon Healthcare, the ARC, the Ombudsman's Office, SPD, and the Governor's Commission for providing us services. Some of our task force recommendations have been drafted into bills by Legislative Council and at the request of Representative Dembro and the Public Guardian Task Force. I've listed four LC numbers for you. 2328 would extend the work of this task force through October 1st, 2013. LC 2526 would require the court to appoint legal counsel in protective proceedings under certain circumstances and extend the right to hearing under certain circumstances. It would amend ORS 125080. LC 2527 and 2618, they appear to be duplicate bills. I'm not sure how we got two out, but we did, establishes a statewide Office of Public Guardian and Conservator and amends ORS 125710. In the current version of the draft, it could continue to work with the counties who operate programs. We do have some suggested amendments to all of those LC drafts, and we hope to be bringing those forward to you in the session. In addition, I'm going to summarize the findings of our task force report. I want to let you know that it's still in progress. Representative Dembro has emailed you a more current version of the executive summary than I had. So there's some minor changes, and I want to let you know that we're continuing to work on it. We don't officially end until you come into session, so we have a little bit more time to squeak out some reports. What is guardianship? And why are we talking about it? I wanted to just say that as part of my retirement, I had the opportunity to think about what my personal mission would be. And it's based upon a reading from the book of Micah. And I can summarize it in six words, which is pretty good for an attorney. It's act justly, love tenderly, and walk humbly. And what we're talking about today are a group of people. Those are those people who don't have services, who require the support of the state to make either financial, health care, or other decisions. And walk justly, we need to create a program to meet this needs, and we need to do something about their due process rights. And the last is walk humbly. We realize that you don't have a lot of resources, and this is a struggling session. So what we're recommending is less of the Cadillac and more of the Pinto variety of things that we'd like you to provide, and I'll talk about those recommendations, realizing in the future, should we have the opportunity and there is funding, that we would expand those recommendations.
And, Margie, you have given us a lot of information here, so if you could sum it up, that would be terrific.
I'd be happy to. The first is that we don't currently have a statewide program. We need to have statewide access. We have just pockets of programs across the state. The second is that we are only one of four states who doesn't provide a right to counsel in protected proceedings, and we have only limited circumstances in which hearings are required. Both of our solutions in terms of right to counsel for the indigent and in which we would require hearings would only be if there's an objection or the court determines it. So we're not saying you have a hearing if somebody objects or the court decides you don't need it. So it's an interim step, but it would provide protection to those people who are at risk for having some of their decision-making authority removed or limited. In addition, we would like you to consider creating a statewide office of public guardian, initially just a person who could work with the task force to develop the programs and services, ultimately then to actually fund some statewide efforts. Again, realizing that we'd like to coordinate. There was lots of discussions on the models of services, and the model that we think would be best would be an independent state office similar to the long-term care ombudsman. In about 11 or 12 of the states, the office is housed within the Social Service Department, but that creates conflicts of interest because the Social Service Agency is also one who's also providing many of the services, including adult protective service, health care, and other things, and they can't both make the decision and provide the service. That's why we need an independent state agency. We have come up with a whole list of duties, what eligibility for services are. One of the most important elements of a public guardianship program, if you have it, you do it well, and you only limit people when the limitations are necessary. So the principle we use to define that is least restrictive alternative. If in Jeff's case, the only service the person needed was money management, then that would be provided, not necessarily location to a different place or healthcare decisions if you didn't require that. So we want to make sure that what we provide is given in the least restrictive manner, that before the appointment of a guardian, that the person gets due process of law, and that if they don't have the means to pay for counsel, that they could have it. We've also looked at what the qualifications for public guardianship would be. And in addition, in many states, they also set the standards for those private guardians that Jeff was describing as well, so that the Office of the Public Guardian, if it was created, could also set some standards for how private guardians would provide service. It is a fiduciary relationship. You're making decisions, you're making financial decisions, and you need to take adequate care. And I think that would wrap it up. I know Representative Dembro has a few more things he'd like to say.
Thank
I
you,
did
Margie.
It in the
Good
speed
job.
Of light.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Terrific. Thank you.
Yes. No, that was great. And we'd be happy to answer your questions. But, you know, one of the things that I learned, you know, we learn a lot in this committee, of course, and My work on this task force has further sensitized me to the difficulty of many of these guardianship decisions, right? Because remember, when you are creating a guardian for someone, you're taking away their rights, in a sense, and to make decisions on their own behalf. It's deemed that they are incapable of making decisions on their own behalf. The individual may disagree with that. And so it's a constant balancing act between concern about the welfare of the individual and also respecting their rights. We were, we were helped by having a representative from Disability Rights Oregon, Jan Friedman, on the committee, and she really helped us as we were working through these issues. So this principle of least restrictive alternative is, you know, really runs through all of our recommendations as well.
Thank you, Representative. Yes. Any quick questions of anyone on this panel? Good work.
Yes.
Best of luck to you. We look forward to seeing this legislation in the next.
Thank you. Yes, and one of the pieces will be a committee bill, so we'll be talking about it. I do want to say Marcy Ingledew from the ARC was hoping to be here.
Right.
She couldn't get here till 10:30, and so she'll have testimony, which we'll distribute.
Great. Thank you so much, Representative. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we're going to be hearing from the Oregon Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Attorney General John Kroger is here. He's chair of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Good morning, Attorney General. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. And I've been asked to testify to give the committee an update on the work of the state's Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission and a summary of legislation that we will be bringing to this committee. As you look as a legislature at the giant issues facing the state, I would hope you would view Oregon's drug and alcohol abuse problem as one of the five or six truly big issues that the state should tackle and that will have a transformative effect on the state if we tackle it properly. I view this very much as an issue which, if not at the top of the list, as I would put economic development or government reform, is clearly right up there on the list of things that truly matter to the future of our state. The reason for that is twofold. One is drug and alcohol abuse in Oregon right now costs the state over $5 billion a year in lost economic productivity because of workforce problems and a huge amount of expense in state government. Drug and alcohol abuse is a primary driver of our state healthcare budget, our state public safety budgets, and our state child welfare budgets. Oregon also has a real problem. Just a couple of statistics. We're currently fourth in the nation for alcohol-induced deaths, which gives you some idea of the problem of drinking. The number of Oregon eighth graders who have had an alcoholic drink in the past month is twice the national average. So for our middle school students, they have much greater both access to and use of alcohol than in the national average. Right now, 72% of the people we are arresting in Multnomah County for property crimes have some controlled substance in their bloodstream at the time of their arrest. 50% of the people who are arrested for violent crimes have a controlled substance in their bloodstream at the time of their arrest. I can tell you as an average, somewhere around 70% of our criminal justice budget is being driven by people who have substance abuse problems and are caught up in our criminal justice system. If we tackle this problem correctly, you will see greater economic productivity and you will save money in the state budget. You will have lower budgets for public safety, for health care, and for child welfare. The Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission was created by the last legislature to get a group of people together, both stakeholders and experts to try to provide some guidance to the legislature about the kinds of things the state needs to do to create a world-class prevention and treatment system. The bill which we are going to be bringing you in the next legislative session does four things. First, it creates a statewide director for alcohol and drug policy and prevention and for treatment. And for me, this is absolutely essential. It's something that every state that's made real progress has. And the reason is very simple. In my 2 years in state government, I've learned profoundly, unless someone, one person, is responsible for something and you can hold them accountable, you will not make any progress. Right now, prevention and treatment services are split amongst a half dozen primary agencies plus a lot of separate ones. And they're really uncoordinated in any profound strategic way. And unless we have someone who reports directly to the governor is on the hook for running this thing and helping make progress, I do not think we will. Second, the legislation would create a unified budget for prevention and treatment. Right now, what happens is each individual agency that has a piece of treatment or prevention brings you a separate budget. Those budgets have really never been discussed between agencies. So there's currently no discussion, for example, of whether the funding level at the Department of Corrections for treatment makes sense given what's over at the Department of Human Services. And then those budgets tend to go to separate subcommittees of Ways and Means. So again, we don't have a unified discussion. Is this the most cost-effective place to put our money or not? And so what this would create is a unified budget. The state director would bring to the legislature on a effectively a single piece of paper, here's the coordinated budget for the executive branch. All of the agency heads who have a stake in this will be required by the legislation to sit down and work out what the unified budget is and present it jointly. So we'll have all those discussions about where we think as a group, as an executive branch, we think the money is best spent. And you'll get a ability to say, well, why are we putting the money over here in treatment versus prevention? Why are we putting the money in treatment at DHS, not corrections? How much are we putting into drug courts and why? We'll be able to have that coordinated policy discussion, which the fragmentation of the budget currently does not allow. Third, we're going to completely transform how we collect data on drug treatment programs. And I don't mean to be overly, well, I guess I do mean to be overly blunt. I don't think the current data collection system adequately provides meaningful accountability for participants in the program, nor does it provide the legislature with the kind of policy, the kind of data that you will need to make reasonable policy decisions. Right now, I cannot tell you which programs are having the biggest impact on recidivism. I can't tell you which ones are most cost effective. I can't tell you which treatment providers are getting better results than others. There is simply no consistent, unified data collection system that will let you compare apples to apples across programs, across providers, and to compare cost effectiveness with the impact on recidivism, let alone other things like employment. And so the legislation is going to create a unified data collection system for the state. And I'm still sort of working on the details of that. It'll have a unified set of data that all programs who are receiving state funding are required to collect. It will have software which providers who currently do not have any automated software to collect that data will be required to use. And other providers will be required to have software that communicates with that software so that we will have a interoperable online data collection system. And then we're going to try to clean up how audits are done. Right now, for a treatment provider, they have multiple audits coming from the federal government, state government, county government, city governments. All of them have different requirements. All of them are on different time frames. What we're going to try to do is conform the data required for auditing to the federal requirements and harmonize the whole system so that we can have one effective audit as opposed to five separate independent audits. The fourth thing that we're going to tackle is how the state deals with prevention programs. And The two things I would tell you about prevention right now, one of the things that's come out from trying to really have a unified discussion about budgeting is that I think the general consensus is that even though we think treatment is still underfunded given the demand in the state, we're even our underfunding on prevention is even greater. And that is the place where I think you will have the biggest bang for the buck long term if we put more money on the prevention side. The other thing I would say about prevention is that there's lots of well-meaning efforts throughout the state. Only a pretty small percentage of those really reflect the best available scientific evidence about what truly works. And a lot of the programs that we have are not concentrated. They're spread out evenly and thus diluted to the extent that you're really not having a significant impact on communities. The last thing I would say about prevention is that for most of us, what is currently viewed as most productive is very different than what we've been exposed to, particularly earlier in our lives when we were middle school or high school students or college students. There's been a real revolution in prevention, and our state programs don't really reflect that. The old model was really pathology specific. If you want to tackle smoking, you do a smoking unit in the schools. If you want to tackle drinking, you do something on drinking. The research over the last 30 years, which has involved countless hundreds of thousands of students in randomized testing over a bunch of different types of programs, has shown that the things in prevention that work most are often interventions that work with parents and children alike. So they're not just focused in the school. There's a significant public health component. It's a basic fact that starting with prenatal care has a huge impact on later drug and alcohol abuse. And the kinds of things that impact one of these pathologies tends to impact all of them. The same group of things, and there are roughly 30 or 40 things we've identified that you can do as a state that have a significant impact on drug and alcohol abuse, also have a significant impact on dropout rate, on smoking, on weapons possession, and on arrest rate. So what we're going to be bringing you is a proposal for pilot programs that will deliver in an undiluted fashion the proven, tested prevention things that actually move the needle in terms of all of those pathologies, and to do it in an undiluted way in a series of communities around the state. We have determined that to do what we think will be really, truly a nationwide leader in how you deliver prevention is $750,000 for every community that's got 20,000 people in it. Crook County, for example, is one county we've just focused on because it happens to have 20,000 people in it. So to do what we think would be needed for Crook County would be $750,000. I know this is a session where there's literally no money to go around. So what we're going to bring to you is a proposal to establish a series of pilot programs. I'm going to be going between January and the end of session to every major private grant-making foundation, both locally and in the United States, to try to get money for this, because obviously the extent that we can get private foundation dollars to start this during the recession, that would be extraordinarily beneficial to the state. We are working with the federal government to pay for the measurement outcomes portion of this. They are interested enough in this as a truly cutting-edge effort to do prevention properly, that we think we will be able to get them to underwrite the cost of measuring the outcomes. And so then what we'll be asking is, given however much foundation money I've been able to raise, that we try to find the dollars to do as many of these pilot programs as you think we can afford. I would think that the optimal number is somewhere around 10, which would be $7.5 million, and I think that would be a great start. The idea of doing it as a pilot program is not just because we're broke. I do not want to try to do something scaled out all over the state without having a chance to really test what this thing looks like and work out the kinks and make sure that what we believe will be successful does in fact work before we ask anyone to try to scale out it any farther. I will tell you, this is probably the single most thing the people on the commission who've worked on it for the last year and a half are most excited about. We've brought in experts from all over the country to work on this. And so I'd be happy if individual members are interested in having a more detailed discussion about what the pilot projects would look like. I'd be happy to come to your office and flesh it out in a little more detail prior to the session. One issue on prevention, which we have not yet tackled, but I will throw out there, and that is the lack of consolidation. Currently, our prevention efforts in the state are split between addictions and mental health, the Liquor Control Commission, the Commission on Children and Families, the Department of Education, Public Health, and Transportation. And they're even more fragmented than on the treatment side. I think one thing that I think people should think about is whether the state would be better off trying to consolidate prevention activity in one part of state government, because I don't think it's optimal to have that degree of fragmentation. The last thing I would throw out there, we are not proposing radical changes in how drug treatment itself is delivered in the state. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the first most important thing I think we need to do is get the data collection piece in place. I am in some ways I often feel like I'm a one-person constituency for this, but for me it is absolutely essential. I think without that data, you really can't begin to see what changes you'd want to make. And so for me, that's the first most important thing on treatment to do. The second thing to tell you is that if the national health care bill is funded and stays on the books, and God knows there's a big debate about what's going to happen with that bill, it will have a enormous impact on how we deliver drug treatment. Most Oregon, the basic insurance package will include substance abuse treatment for the first time. I view this as transformative in terms of public safety, because we'll be able to get a huge number of people into alcohol and drug treatment that we currently cannot get into treatment. And it will do that through the state health care plan, which will be more efficient. And so what we are going to recommend to the legislature is that we try to fund treatment, recognizing all the budget pressures that you're going to have. We try to fund treatment in a way that keeps the basic treatment infrastructure of the state up and running, so that we have the capacity to deliver treatment when more funding comes onto the system in 2014. So that is a summary of the bill that we'll be bringing you. The other thing I would say, there's a number of discussions going on with other legislators and with other government agencies about, particularly about alcohol policy. And the Drug and Alcohol Policy Commission, at the request of agencies or individual legislators, has taken up and voted on certain of these things, and has asked me to make recommendations to the legislature about what makes sense. Four issues briefly. One idea that's been discussed, and I think is a very good idea, is expanding the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to include a member of the law enforcement community and a member of a public health expert on that commission. And the OLCC has abstained from those discussions. Their position has been, whatever you tell us the board composition is, that will be the board composition. But I think this is a very fine idea. I know Chair Tomei is working on a bill to that effect. I think that is something that would be a very wise decision for the state to take. I will also tell you that it has extraordinarily strong support from the law enforcement community, which believes that given the importance of enforcement in our alcohol enforcement scheme of the OLCC, the chiefs of police in particular, believe it's very important to have law enforcement representation on that board. Second is the issue of alcohol outlet density. When I introduced my testimony this morning, I noted that we're fourth in the nation for alcohol-related deaths, and that our middle school drinking is twice the national average. When you ask experts what impacts those statistics, they will tell you overwhelmingly it is two things. It is density of alcohol outlets, and it is price. Most states have some method of controlling the density of outlets, meaning both restaurants and bars where alcohol is served, as well as convenience stores and other outlets where you can buy alcohol. Oregon really has no method of controlling density. It used to, and it was eliminated in the 1990s. The OLCC is working on a proposal to allow local communities to have a greater say about the density of alcohol outlets in their community. And I know Chair Tomei is working on legislation as well. Those two bills are actually very similar to each other, so I would expect that between the chair and the OLCC and the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission will come up with something that we agree on. The two drafts under discussion are very similar and very close in detail. Why this is important, I think there are two reasons. One is, from a philosophical matter, some of us, and I include myself in this, believe local communities should have greater control over exactly how much alcohol is being dished out in their local community. And if some communities want to have fewer outlets, I think that's something that they should be given the power to help help make happen. The second reason is that our density is a major contributing factor to our alcohol problems, which all of us pay for, both in the amount we're spending on the child welfare system, the healthcare system, the public safety system. And so I personally would like to see that monitored more closely and to have less density in some areas. The third issue that the OLCC is looking at, and we will try to help them with, is a little wider power to ban certain harmful alcoholic drinks. As you may have followed, the national furor over the Four Loko beverage, which had the equivalent of three or four beers plus four or five cups of coffee in one $2.50 can. The state did ban beverages like Four Loko. The OLCC did that. I think it was fantastic. They did an emergency meeting on a Saturday in order to get that accomplished. We were allowed to do that primarily because the federal government had made findings about the adulteration of the product and its lack of safety effects. So we're going to be discussing with the OLCC whether they need a little more flexibility from a public health point of view to have the power to ban substances that are particularly harmful. The last issue I'd love to take up, and it's a controversial one, is the question of beer and wine taxes. I have nothing to say from a revenue point of view. That's obviously not my job, and I'm very happy that that's not my job, to figure out how much the revenue the state needs and where it should come from. I will tell you that everyone who works on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, which is ideologically a very great range of people, having debated the issue off and on for over a year, voted unanimously to recommend to the legislature that we have some increase in the beer and wine tax. Nothing to do with revenue policy, everything to do with public safety and public health. The population that is influenced by price of alcoholic beverages are teenagers. If you look at the studies, adults really aren't that price sensitive, so very small raises in the price of beer and wine do not have a big impact on what adults drink and what they choose to drink. The group of people that do are the middle school students who are not legally allowed to drink, the high school students who are not legally allowed to drink, and college students. And so from a policy perspective, both from the law enforcement community and from public health, there is universal agreement that if we had at least some increase in the beer and wine tax that raised the price of some of those beverages, you would see a decline in the use amongst our middle school students, our teenagers, and our college students. And given the crisis levels of alcohol abuse in the state, that would be a wise idea. The beer and wine tax hasn't been raised since 1977. I think it's important to recognize that both the beer and wine industries are major ones for Oregon. They are a bright spot in our economic development picture, I will simply tell you that there are ways to craft a beer and wine tax that would protect those industries, particularly the niche brewing and winery industries that we've got, and still have the positive public health and public safety impacts, which a higher price for some of these beverages would have. So, for what it is worth, from a public safety and public health perspective, that is the universal viewpoint. And with that, I'm sorry if I've gone on too long, Madam Chair, but I will be happy to answer any questions that anyone might have.
I think you've been just perfect, Mr. Attorney General. Any questions? President Freeman.
Thank you. I want to applaud you on working on this issue. Your description of the way to track the budgeting and the outcomes, I could not have explained it better myself. I had that frustration on the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means trying to just figure out the dollars, let alone the outcomes. So I'm very excited that you're working on this, and please keep going. Is there anything I can do to help? Let me know.
Madam Chair, Representative, I, in part, it grows out of the same I feel your frustration. If the budgets aren't transparent and you can't figure out dollars that are being spent to tackle the same program, if you can't figure out where they're really going and how much there is, it's impossible to make wise decisions. And where this conversation started was a recognition that we simply did not know as a state how much we were spending on treatment and prevention. I mean, no one had a dollar figure. And so we're in a, I will tell you, Representative, and when we get to the budget this coming year, you'll already be able to see some improvement. We'll be able to give you a much better sense. We're not yet at the unified budget stage, but we'll be able to give you a much better sense of what the state is spending on treatment and prevention across all the agencies, where that money comes from, and you'll be able to have a better sense of what the priorities are and why.
Thank you.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And at the risk of being political on my way out, sometimes it is incredibly frustrating to watch people's activism, kind of cloud their judgment. But I really appreciate your activism in this issue. It is greatly needed. I think you're going to find a whole lot of support. The issue in Southern Oregon has been devastating and continues to be devastating, and the impacts economically, socially are just tremendous, and I wish you good luck.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you very much. It is not a partisan issue in any way, and drug and alcohol abuse affects every single community in the state. There are some that are affected worse than others, but it is at a very serious level in every part of the state, and I don't view what I've been doing as activism so much as just basic good government. I feel like this, I have no budget stake in any of this. None of this money goes to my agency, and that probably makes it easier for me to tackle it, quite frankly. So I appreciate the kind words.
Well, but activism is meant in a kind way, so thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Attorney General Kroger, thank you so much for doing this. I'm so excited to hear about what you've got on deck here, particularly the prevention piece. And it's been so hard to prove that it works, but I think you're getting there and will get there. And so I would love to have, at least in my district, wouldn't be one of those communities you pilot in on your program. And I want to be sitting next to him in the front seat of the bus as he takes off, because this is going to be big. And we heard earlier in this room, one case, I don't know if you were in here at the time, how one case of alcohol abuse or substance abuse used in utero can affect a child's life, and how difficult it can be on everybody around them too. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Doing good work.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Well, I think one of the benefits for me was the work that was done and illustrated for me the complexity of the funding, and that you've got many agencies receiving federal dollars. So one of the questions that I have is relative to those federal dollars. Will there be some, when you talk about coordination, does that include oversight over those funds that we get from the feds? Because they're not exactly coordinated either.
The Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, the goal would be to have the state director oversee and be responsible for all prevention and treatment provided with state funding. And that would include the federal money that we get and then allocate as a state. Yes, the goal is to really bring all of this conversation and provide a state director that will be the focal point for all those discussions in the executive branch and with the legislature. With treatment, having looked at our delivery system, I don't think it's conceivable to put all of the activities into one agency because the place where treatment is delivered is just so radically different. Some of them are in an incarcerated setting, some are not, and thus having different agencies delivering those services seems to us the right way to go, as long as we have better budget and policy coordination about what we're trying to achieve. The lack of coordination on the prevention side is very different. I cannot say that my views currently represent a consensus on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, because we really haven't had these discussions. But as I've gone deeper into what we're doing on treatment, I do believe that trying to place all of our treatment activities into one state entity, wherever that is, would give us greater accountability and consistency.
Thank you so much, Mr. Attorney General. It's been very exciting to be on the commission. And as someone said in the commission meeting 2 days ago, you're a numbers person. I appreciate that. I think it creates for us transparency that we're certainly needing in state government. Was there someone else? Michael, a quick question.
Yes, just a quick question, Don. And I really appreciate the deliberate way that you went about this. You know, many of us had our own areas that we wanted to see your office work on, and you said, no, we're going to go at this in a very deliberative fashion by means of this task force. I really appreciate that. In terms of the director position, what are you envisioning for that? I mean, how independent would this position be? Because this person is obviously going to have to coordinate a number of agencies. Who would she or he report to? You know, how big an entity are you kind of thinking about at this point?
Hopefully a very small entity. I think the way we currently have it drafted is for a statewide director that would be appointed by the governor. We have created a oversight commission, and philosophically, one could, quite honestly, I'm often of a mixed mind about the value of government by commission in certain respects. In this case, I have to tell you, having had the experience of chairing the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, the way we've structured this commission, I think, will be very valuable, because what it has is all the stakeholders on it. And so we've used the commission, for example, as the way in which we're going to get a coordinated budget. The head of DHS, the head of corrections, the head of OIA, a representative of the Judicial Department, which runs the drug courts, all of those are on the commission and on a thing called the Budget Committee, which will be responsible for that coordinated budget. Probably the key person other than director is a job for a person to run the data collection and accountability system, which for me is the key. One of my frustrations is that I currently cannot give the legislature really much feedback about whether our dollars are being spent in the most wise allocation today, because I simply don't have the data to tell you. I can give you some estimates based on programs run in other parts of the country, but that the quality of programs varies so dramatically from one place to the next that data collection piece becomes important. And I've always viewed this, Representative, as not a 2-year process, we flip a light switch and everything is better. I view this as a 10-year process to go from where we are today to having a truly first-class system. And the bedrock for me will be the data collection system. If we get that right, that will make everything else easier. If we do a poor job, we'll do it poorly. So the simple answer is a very, very small entity.
But a powerful entity, it sounds like.
We have drafted it in such a way that it has real responsibility, and thus you can really hold the person accountable.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Thank you. We look forward to looking at the legislation during the next legislative session.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming today. Thank you, Mary Ellen. Okay, we're going to be hearing now about human trafficking, addressing sexual exploitation of children. Okay.
I don't know if you were here. They called it the spider chart. You have these fundings for these programs. Mm-hmm. It was a piece of paper that had all the different funding sources and where they came from, and all the different program types.
And the lines are protocol. Like, yes. You need to give us your name before you. Committee, are we ready to listen?
Affirmative.
Okay, go ahead.
Dr. Mallon Boone.
Madam Chair, good morning. My name is Tom Cleary, T-O-M-C-L-E-A-R-Y. I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I have the privilege of supervising the juvenile division. And with me, I'll have you introduce yourself.
Sure. J.R. Ujikusa. I'm a deputy district attorney for Multnomah County. My current position is the neighborhood prostitution deputy out of East Precinct.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. As a juvenile prosecutor in the county, I'm always pleased when we get an opportunity to share some of the things that are going on with regard to youth in our county. One of the pieces that we're here to talk with you today about is the human trafficking issue. Deputy District Attorney Ujikusa deals with this exclusively every day. We'd like to give you a picture of what's going on with youth and then discuss with you the tools that are available to us and what law enforcement and other parts of the community are telling us are necessary in order to make an impact with regard to this problem.
Chair Tomei, I handed out a handout representatives. For some reason, I'm going to switch computers real quickly with my computer that I brought for the presentation for a PowerPoint. That shows all the slides available in the PowerPoint. I will begin talking with an overview as I set this up.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Sure.
This presentation is going to be focusing on three things. The first is what is happening right now with sex trafficking of minors. The recruiting of minors used in sex trafficking and the complex bond between pimps, traffickers, and their victims. We will then talk about the options currently available and the procedure for helping these victims break this bond and receive help for successfully heal. We will then focus on the tools available and steps to take to further this cycle and revictimization. And avoid revictimization, I'm sorry. First, humans are recycled and resold. Humans are now the third most lucrative commodity traded illegally after drugs and guns. One of the reasons for this is the fact that, unlike guns and drugs, a individual human can be trafficked multiple times, made money every time. When you sell a gun, you are done with that gun. When you sell drugs, you are done with those drugs. Unlike that, humans can be resold and recycled. The stats show us that one out of every three teens on the street will be lured into prostitution within 48 hours of leaving home. Now we can imagine what will happen 72 hours after that, but that statistically shows that at least 150,000 children are lured into prostitution each year.
That's in the United States, I'm assuming.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And thank you for being patient with the slideshow. I hope it's working now. Pimps and traffickers are motivated by money. I use the term pimps and traffickers interchangeably, so if I talk about a trafficker or a pimp, we'll understand that it's both. This is usually displayed by the number age and attractiveness of the women and girls they have working for them. For them, younger is better. They also show this by the car they drive, the clothes they wear, and how loyal and hardworking their women or girls are to them. These motivations are later adopted by their victims as a way to show their loyalty, love, and their worth to their pimp or trafficker. Some of the photographs we have seized on phones, on social networking sites from pimps and traffickers. There are three stages in the pimp trafficking model. The first is the recruiting stage. The second is called the breaking stage, and the third is the maintenance stage. It varies from individual to individual, victim to victim, how long it takes to get from stage one to stage three. But I've seen it as little as a few hours to up to a year. The recruiting stage is first finding a vulnerable victim. It is usually a minor. Although I've seen many studies, the studies seem to suggest that the average age of a sexually trafficked victim ranges from about 12 to 14 years of age. The majority of these victims come from a broken home or an unstable home. They have a history of runaways, physical, sexual, verbal abuse, and low self-esteem. For pimps and traffickers, a history of sexual abuse is a bonus because sex acts are how many victims of sexual abuse define their self-worth or love. This makes it much easier for that pimp and trafficker to persuade the victim to sell themselves for sexual acts for money. Many pimps, traffickers that have been interviewed and spoken with by law enforcement brag that they can detect the vulnerabilities they need in a victim before they even speak to them. They look for victims at malls, bus stops, public transportation sites, junior highs, high schools, the internet, social networking sites, foster homes, shelters, etc. They use their most trustworthy girl, or otherwise known as their bottom girl, to sometimes recruit for them. This does two things. It makes it easier to approach victims on the street. They trust a female more than a male, and it glamorizes the lifestyle that they're trying to recruit them into. Part of this recruiting stage is to make their victims fall in love with them or emotionally depend on them. Many traffickers start out by transporting the victim to another part of town or even another state to make it so they're unfamiliar with their surroundings. They make false promises, glamorize their status. They tell them they love them and feed into their insecurities and low self-esteem. They flash money, jewelry, buying things for victims and spoiling them. At the same time during this recruiting stage, they are learning what the victim's vulnerabilities and insecurities are for future exploitation. During this recruiting stage, they also exercise control over all things, including money, even the victim's ID, where they can go, how they can dress, who they can contact, when they can leave, to go to the store, to go to the restroom. The bond between the pimp, trafficker, and the victim is similar to the Stockholm Syndrome or domestic violence relationships. They are forced to accept this lack of control and eventually avoid placing themselves in situations where they regain too much autonomy. Many victims during this recruiting stage are branded by their pimp or trafficker with hot metal hangers or tattoos to signify that they are just property to their trafficker or pimp. Next, we get to the breaking stage. When the trafficker or pimp detects that the victim is ready to be put out on the street or to work for them, the pimp trafficker alters their personality. I've heard this in many different ways, but usually or sometimes the victim is physically raped by the pimp or trafficker or an associate and then is persuaded or talked into selling sex that is not that big of a deal. The pimp changes his mood from being the caretaker and the boyfriend to being aggressive and forcing that victim to make money to repay them for their kindness and generosity. This can be done by physical force, by the use of drugs, alcohol, by manipulation, and sometimes by the pimp or trafficker's associates. From then on, victims will have a monetary quota to fill nightly, 365 days a year. If this quota is not filled, usually the pimp will make an example out of them by physically assaulting them or emotionally assaulting them as well. At this point, the victim only has contact with buyers of sex and those associated with the pimp and trafficker. This can include family members, friends, and associates who are only loyal to the pimp or trafficker. The maintenance stage, or as some pimps, traffickers call it, when their victim is on automatic, is at the point where the victim is so brainwashed by the pimp trafficker that his constant surveillance, control, and monitoring is not needed. Once on automatic, the victims will work whether or not their trafficker is present, whether or not he is a reasonable threat. This includes times when he is in another state, in jail, or in prison. The money they make will still be given directly to the pimp trafficker, or wired to them, or put on their books if they're in custody, without taking any for themselves. Many ask, why does this problem continue after the pimp trafficker is arrested? Likely, associates of this pimp trafficker will make the victim continue to make money, making sure she does not snitch, testify, or make court appearances. If that does not happen, the victim will be sought out by other pimps or traffickers, knowing that she is alone and has been trafficked previously. Without safety, long-term care, and support, the victim will fall prey to another pimp trafficker in the near future or will return to the previous one.
The current options available to law enforcement as they come into contact with these youth engaged in these operations right now are a bit limited. The first option is that they can take them to a reception center. That reception center is not a secure facility, and that will become important as we go through this presentation to understand the difference between secure and not secure. Good people at the reception center that will work in the youth's best interest, but it does require that the youth stay and participate. The officers also obviously can contact a parent or a guardian. For a lot of these individuals, unfortunately, that is not an option. It's not uncommon for the parents or guardians not to be cooperative at that point out of frustration and difficulty that they've had dealing with the individual. The other piece is they can access the Department of Human Services for foster care placement. Again, it's not a secure placement. We'll hear some data that will illuminate the problem surrounding that from Mr. Cerise and the folks from DHS. The overwhelming majority of youth that are picked up engaged in this activity that are placed into foster placement actually leave the foster care. And unfortunately, when they leave, it's not uncommon for them to leave with others who are placed in foster care. And so we have compounded the problem. A custodial setting booking a youth into a detention facility is not available under the current Oregon revised statutes. The benefit, of course, we get from the use of a detention setting is that we're able to control the youth's movement, secure the youth from outside negative influences, provide an educational component that they're suffering from, and provide them, frankly, with a warm, safe place, dry place to be with proper nutrition. We also, at that point, have the opportunity for service providers to engage with these youth. One of the issues that will be presented, if it hasn't already on this, is that, well, aren't you really just treating the victim as a criminal? And I can tell you that our detention facility does not operate in that way. It is an environment that is populated by professionals who know that we are dealing with youth. They're not just little adults. And their needs and the difficulties that they're experiencing are dealt with and understood. In those rare cases where we are not able to effect some change, then we do need the opportunity to access OYA resources. Frankly, one of the major benefits that Oregon Youth Authority brings to us in these cases is that we're able to remove the youth from the geographical area. If you've seen some media-type programs that have been done on this issue, you will notice that those who are interviewed who have successfully left this lifestyle are no longer in the area where it started. It makes perfect sense. But these pimps and these traffickers are tenacious. If they can get a hold of these individuals, they will. And so by moving the youth out of the area, that is helpful. In order to do that, under the current Oregon revised statutory scheme, we've got to have an A misdemeanor or above. In order to have that tool, currently prostitution is an A misdemeanor, and we're able to use that.
The serious emotional damage and trauma associated with this type of victimization needs a system to follow through and deprogram these individuals to stop the cycle of returning to be victimized. I've heard an officer say pimps spend 110% of their time looking for victims to exploit, where law enforcement spends less than that to try to help them out. So we are dealing with a problem where these individuals are tenacious, as Mr. Cleary put it. Long-term treatment and follow-up to address these children's needs cannot be executed if the victims are unable to be located, transient, or surrounded by traffickers and pimps and their associates. I have dealt with many victims, and from their own mouths, the victims tell us what needs to be in place to free them from this life. It is eloquent in its simplicity. They say, "You have to hold me so that I cannot leave. It must be for more than a day. You have to take my cell phone away from me."
Thank you. Any quick questions from either of you?
I do have a quick question. What are the criminal penalties against, are they very severe against pimps and the people who purchase sex?
You have to forgive me, I'm new with this protocol, so Chair Tomei, Representative Doherty, penalties for compelling fall within ORS 137-707, also known as Ballot Measure 11, so they are severe. However, I would not be complete in my explanation to your question if I didn't point out these are very difficult to prosecute because we need the cooperation. And if we are not able to get that youth to a point where, most often it's a she, so I'll use that, but it can be a he, where she's able to testify, that case is seriously compromised, and we're not able to take that person
off. So it is, what about the purchaser of sex?
It is a Class A misdemeanor at this point.
Thank you. We're working on this. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you aware of what's happened in Stockholm, how they're handling this? And they basically go after the Johns. They don't, they do, of course, if you can prosecute, we'll get the pimps. But they don't victimize the young women and young men. They do have shelter care, but they go after the Johns, they publish names, nobody is exempt. High level people in government, et cetera. And I don't know numbers or anything like that, but I know it's been pretty successful in terms of just the deterrent of that it might happen. And they do it via photographs, cell phone, they can tap phones easier than we can, but things like that they get people, whether or not they're prosecuted, they just in action, whatever they're doing. And I just wondered if I know there's one or two people there, and it's a city police, it's probably like your county sheriff's office, but maybe could look into how they do it, you know.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Jim.
Thank you. gentlemen, you've described scenarios that are more what we think of as traditional prostitution, but how about young women finding themselves involved in the adult entertainment industry? Is that something that you come up against as well? I've heard some complaints about that they become kind of magnets for activity, and
young women who are they're underage to begin with. They shouldn't be involved in those in that kind of work. In any case, are also crossing the being coerced to cross the line into out and out prostitution.
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembro, yes, we are familiar with those types of cases. If you can imagine a traditional, as you call it, case being difficult to prosecute, behind closed doors of some of these adult industries you're talking about can even be more difficult and labor-intensive for law enforcement. But we are looking into all areas. When we talk about traditional pimp trafficking types of cases, there are the internet, there are escort service, there are street prostitution type cases as well. So it is a huge area, but some of the, I think most of the traditional ways in which these individuals pick their victims and find their victims is similar in every case.
Mm-hmm. And just follow up, do you feel that you have the tools that you need to deal with those non-traditional kinds of sources, or is the real challenge just being able to locate and identify? But once you have done, been able to do so, you, do you feel that you have the resources to prosecute those adult entertainment or internet or, you know, whatever these alternative kinds of programs are?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembro, that's an excellent question. In that, I deal with the juvenile realm and not in the adult piece. We will research that and get back to you. I think that our adult prosecutors in that deal with that every day will have a more complete and accurate answer than I would have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And could one of you talk about some about the trafficking up and down I-5 corridor? We've heard how Oregon and Seattle are among the highest percentage of especially underage prostitutes.
Chair Tomei, human trafficking routes follow what were traditionally drug trafficking routes. On one of the slides, we talked about a pimp or trafficker taking an individual out of an area they know to another place in order to do their pimping and their trafficking. Because the I-5 corridor has a couple large cities in that corridor, we see a lot of switching between these cities because they have a high demand. It's a place where they can make money. So we see, a lot of times we will see minors from Portland in Washington, miners from Washington in Portland, because what they're doing is they're taking that tactic of making it so the only person they know is their trafficker and using that and traveling down the I-5 corridor, following the routes that some of these individuals may have already traveled in their drug trade or may not, but may have heard about places to go. So yes, we see that happening. I think the second part of your question was the high percentage in both Seattle and Portland. I believe that we do have a problem, and it is a big problem. I don't know if a study has been done that I think would be conclusive as to how we rate compared to cities our size or cities larger than us with this problem. I know that there has been some media coverage on this. There have been some federal investigations involved, and I think we do have a large problem. And I think it compounds it when we have two pretty large cities, Seattle and Portland, within driving distance of each other. And that problem moves along the I-5 corridor between those two areas, Tacoma and other Vancouver as well. So I can't give you an answer as to exactly where we rate, but the I-5 corridor is a major hub for these individuals to travel back and forth.
Thank you. All right, gentlemen, so you've heard about the problem, and what are we talking about with DHS?
Thank you. I'm glad you didn't ask us for the solution on that one. For the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services. And I'm going to kind of frame how our discussion will take place. We're not going to use the slide presentation, although the handout that you have is the slide presentation that we would use. That would save us a little bit of time, I believe. One of the things that, from a DHS perspective in working with the community, that we are learning. We're learning several things as we go through this process with Multnomah County Community Partners. And I do want to underscore, and you may hear us say this a couple of times in this presentation, that Multnomah County is the lead in the state of Oregon. We are all looking at Multnomah County's process that they are using, because they are the ones that have identified this problem at this time and are putting into place some efforts to correct the problem within current resources or additional resources they're getting on their own as city and county entities. So it's truly a model not only for Oregon. I suspect even nationally we may have some recognition at because of the efforts that are taking place in Multnomah County. But one of the things that was striking to me, we're talking about human trafficking, and you'll notice the title of our slide presentation is Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children, and that's the same population we're talking about. It's simply a different title, and I do believe that we are moving to a system where we're wanting to say that we would like to treat this population more as victims than as offenders. Over the weekend, I listened to a documentary on the Green River serial killer, and I believe that person was around Seattle in the 1980s. And in that conversation, the narrator made a one-sentence statement and said that when interviewing this serial killer after he was arrested, that his preference were teenage prostitutes. So we began over 30 years ago with this problem, talking about them as teenage prostitutes, and we have evolved now to looking at them possibly from a different set of lens or a different perspective. So one of the things that the department is interested in doing and working with the public safety end of the continuum, DHS and the treatment providers maybe being on the human services end of that continuum, it is to begin to look at these individuals as victims, not criminals. And I've worked with Mr. Clary in a number of settings, a lot of interim work groups, and I know his position on this, and I know he needs those tools in his toolbox in order to affect changes now. But I do think by challenging us as a state agency, I think that as a state, I do believe that we're going to be able to come up with some plans that may be able to meet everyone's needs but still treat this particular population more as victims as opposed to offenders. I have a note here that current laws do allow access to services, and that is a true statement, but embedded in that statement is some caution. As Mr. Clary and the Multnomah County group will tell you, we have current laws in place that would allow us to provide services to this population. The problem is those services are not working with this population. So when Mr. Clary mentioned that we have a foster care system that can receive these children, that is correct. It's simply not going to be the effective tool that we need in order to affect positive change. The other two points that I want to make that we're seeing as necessary for us to move to the next step is that we're hearing, even from Multnomah County, that there is a desperate need for training, and that training has to be community-wide. It can't be to simply one agency or one provider. This will take a collaborative effort in order to help and serve this population and move them to a point where they can develop a self-sufficient life outside of the one that they currently know. The fourth thing that we hear pretty consistently is that those services have to be specialized, and no one entity, again, is going to be able to provide all of those particular services. Some of them are case management in nature, some of them will be clinical in nature, for instance, counseling. We do have some statistics that I would like to mention to the group, and I have to put a caveat on the statistics. We gathered statistics, and I say we. I told Miriam Green over the last several months that I've renamed her as we. But all of this has come from Miriam, who is our director of the hotline in Multnomah County. She is our point person for the Multnomah County efforts, so she works with all of the city and county entities around this particular population. And Miriam and her team have actually been hand-counting this population for several years. Having said that, we have gotten better with counting as the years have gone by, so we know these numbers are not accurate, and we know that they are probably an underestimate. But what we have since August of 2007 through November of 2010 is we've identified 138 victims that fit this definition and are being served or were served by the Department of Human Services and possibly some other services in the Multnomah County area. Of that 138, 50%, 69 of those youth were placed in foster care. And I mean foster care in a broader definition, which would include residential treatment services as well. And as Mr. Clary mentioned, our residential treatment is staff secure, but it's not facility secure. So they're not locked facilities, and they may have a heavier staffing ratio with clinicians, but the doors themselves are not locked. The other half were served in other settings, for instance, in their homes. Of the victims that were placed in foster care, 89% ran. So that's almost 90% of the kids that we place in foster care, which is the system that we have in child welfare, doesn't work for 90% of the youth, or close to 90% of those youth. When at one of the meetings that I attended, we were asked to look at the option of federal funding as a leverage for resources available for these youth. And so of those 138 youth that we identified, we pulled 26 files, and we reviewed them for funding eligibility. And what we came up with was that 10 of them, or 38%, qualified for the federal foster care program funding, and 26, or 100% of them, qualified for the Title IV-E or Medicaid funding. So all of that said, we have opened some communication with the Addictions and Mental Health Division within the Oregon Health Authority, and have asked them to sit with us and ponder this question. If we could we develop within our federal funding scheme a plan that would allow law enforcement to pick up a 16-year-old girl who is out on the streets involved in prostitution and bring them to a facility that would immediately engage the federal funds that we have here? We don't have the answer to that question yet, but we have a strong desire to look at that at the state level and then see if we couldn't tie that into some of the plans and programs that are going on in Multnomah County right now. All of this would be focused on Multnomah County for the time being. One thing that I will mention is that and Chair Tome, you mentioned the I-5 corridor. We did an informal survey with our districts throughout the state of Oregon and basically sent out kind of a definition of the commercial sexual exploitation of children and asked them if they have seen this population coming across in our programs, child welfare, self-sufficiency, any of the programs that we have. With two exceptions, one being Multnomah, we basically heard that, no, they haven't been seeing these youth at all. So when we asked for a couple of case results and we went back to those districts and had a conversation with them about this definition, we began to hear, well, yes, I think maybe some of those youth are coming in. We have a need for recognition of this population across the board. Right now, the primary way these young women are entering our system is through law enforcement, because they have the information that they need to recognize these people, and that does force this population to be viewed a little bit more as an offender as opposed to a victim. We believe that in all of our eligibility programs, if we had trained staff, we would be in a better position to recognize these youth, maybe when they're coming in seeking food stamps or seeking medical services. And we would be able to redirect them, hopefully, into some appropriate treatment. I heard Attorney General mentioning how important data is, and we agree with that. We are not collecting adequate data right now through the efforts of the ORCIDS project. I heard that referenced earlier today in another part of your hearing. We do have a mechanism within that system that caseworkers can identify this population. So it's a first step in us not only collecting accurate data about this population as they come into our system, but data that we can use when we start with treatment to see what the outcomes are doing. So we'd be able to use that to help evaluate what programs are working and which ones are not. The second bullet here, I call response, and I stuck that in there because I think very often as social workers, we think about once we identify a problem, the next step that we do is treat it, that we move right to treatment. And in this, with this particular population, that will not work. And I think the DAs did an excellent job in explaining that. We have to recognize this population, and then we have to stop the cycle. We don't move directly into treatment. We have to take them off the street, get them away from their pimps. We have to break that cycle for a period of time. I'm hearing it can be a fairly short period of time. And then once we have that cycle broken, then we can move into some form of treatment, hopefully some specialized treatment. The only thing that we would encourage all of us to do is to look at that response, that placement of that child, in something that with some efforts with the community, some efforts with the department, maybe we could make it more of a clinical setting. I do believe that when Mr. Clary said that that even though the term is detention, I do know that there are clinical elements around that. The problem is the federal government recognizes detention as a locked facility for offenders, and some of the federal dollars do not follow if it's detention. And the last area I wanted to mention is around treatment. And what we are hearing is that we do have a desperate need for specialized treatment for this population. And that treatment has to be comprehensive. Again, it cannot come from one agency. The needs are going to be too great for them to break and then maintain a different lifestyle away from the one that they're used to being involved in. And at this point, I'm going to turn this over to Stacy and let him talk with you a little bit about what we see happening in Multnomah County and where we would like to begin to build on towards some of these more long-term goals.
Thank you, Mickey. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Stacy.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Stacy Ayers. My last name is A-Y-E-R-S. I work for DHS in the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager there. As you know, this is a significant issue, the issue of children who are being sexually exploited. I really quickly, I'm not sure how much time we have, and I'm wondering about how brief I need to be here.
I think 15 minutes for
okay.
Questions and everything. Does that work for you?
That works. I'll try to get through this pretty quickly then. What we know about this issue is that in Portland, again, as Mr. Sharif said, is really taking the lead on this. And really quickly, I do want to acknowledge that there are a couple of people in the audience today from Multnomah County who have really been instrumental in helping to facilitate this treatment issue and coordinating and collaborating with all the different community partners in Multnomah County. I'm going to go through the list a little bit here. here, and then I'm going to introduce them. One of the programs in Multnomah County is the Sexual Assault Resource Center. It's known as SARC. It's on your on the PowerPoint that you guys have in front of you. One of the partners as well is DHS, but specifically the Child Welfare Office, the Child Abuse Hotline in Multnomah County. And as Mr. Sharice said, that's also run by Miriam Green, and she's been a stalwart in making this happen, getting the data, tracking this issue, and really making this work. LifeWorks Northwest, another program providing mental health treatment for these teens who are being victimized. CARES Northwest, and I would assume many of you are familiar with that medical treatment or medical program associated with Legacy Hospital in Portland. Janus Youth Programs and the Reception Center there. And at this point, I'll let you know that Janet Merrill is here in the audience, and Janet is the coordinator in planning and services for minor victims of human trafficking. And I had asked her about that earlier today, about the MVST acronym, and because it's all changing now to CSEC, and she's going to be, her cards will be changed to reflect that. Also here in the audience is Jocelyn Baker, and she's a collaboration specialist in Multnomah County for the Department of Community Justice. And I had asked them to come down here and be present in the audience, and I know that they have to leave here soon, so I wanted to acknowledge them before we got done. One of the issues that I think that, you know, we were dealing with here is that it isn't as if the services that we have don't work. I think there are certain elements of them that do. I think one of the things that we talk about is whether they're evidence-based or not. And I think that that's a struggle right now, because this is, well, as Mr. Sharice said, this is a problem that we've been dealing with for, you know, decades. It's really something that we're starting to kind of look at and address now in a vigorous way, and specifically again in Multnomah County, it's where they're really taking the lead on this. And while I think that everybody is kind of trying to work the best situation as possible, trying to give these kids the best chance that they can, it's not a one size fits all. That's the information that I'm getting, and that's the information that I believe is really important for people to know. When we're looking at these children, it's not we're not going to be dealing with a child who's been on the streets for 7 years, who's got drug and alcohol issues because of their pimp, because of the lifestyle that they've been put into. We're not going to be dealing with them the same way that we would deal with a child who's 12 years old, who's never really been away. This is like the first night maybe that we're catching them, and they've been put into that business, that line of work, essentially, because of a pimp who's basically kidnapped them. And so I think it's important to know that as we're trying to address this issue, there isn't going to be a one answer from every time, from all the different perspectives, from law enforcement, from the advocate community, and from the department. We're trying to tackle this now, and we're trying to come to resolution, and I think we will. I think we'll get to a place where we're all in agreement about how to best address this issue. But it is going to take some time, and as I said, this is something that we've really begun to address over the last year and a half. As far as the data goes, and as far as the ORCID system and the capacity that's built into that, the tracking that we put into our old system, we actually did put like a checkbox in for when the screener receives the call at the hotline to say, hey, this is an allegation of abuse, or this is an allegation of sex abuse. They can actually check that now. The problem is that across the state, I think there's really a lack of understanding about this issue. And so what we've had is people from our own agency, our own offices, we sent an email out across the state to say, hey, how many people have identified this? How many cases do you have in your area? And some offices have said, oh, no, but we do have this one case. And they go on to kind of explain it. And it's exactly what
It's exactly, that fits the definition of children who've been sexually exploited. It's just a lack of understanding, I think, from, you know, the real base level frontline workers who are encountering this, who they're not getting it. They don't understand yet. And that's something that, as an agency, we're working on and trying to get that message out. I think that as we move forward, one of the things, again, as Mr. Sharice pointed out, we're trying to address the issue of funding. That's a huge component for us and kind of how we go about addressing this issue. And we're working with addictions, mental health, and we're trying to free up money that we have to locate beds. I mean, that's a huge issue for us. Right now, there aren't a lot of locations in Portland. It's a limited number of spaces for children who are picked up on the streets in this lifestyle. Okay. And so I would say as we kind of move forward, that is something that we're trying to address right now, and we're trying to identify resources. Training for our staff, as some of you may know, that is a huge issue for us. There isn't really a training budget. There are resources available, and I've had conversations with Jocelyn Baker about the need for training and grants that are available. And I mean, we're in Multnomah County. Miriam Green, she's somebody who's received the GEMS training, as it's known, and she's gone out and done a lot of that training herself to other community partners and staff in the Portland area. So I think that this is something that we need to take across the state. I don't think it's a problem that's isolated to Portland. I think we need to do a more effective job at getting this word out and getting this training out. But we also need to receive it ourselves, frankly. I think we have a flow chart. I think you all have that in front of you, and kind of how the calls come in to us and how it may move through the system. It's fairly self-explanatory. I know that time is limited. I'm going to go ahead and open this up. If you guys have any questions for me, I'm happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you, Stacey. Appreciate both of your coming today and presenting to us. And I want to point out, too, even though a lot of these kids end up in the Portland metropolitan area, I've heard that a lot of them come from the more rural areas, and this is where they end up. And in many ways, they are the most vulnerable because they have no support system in the metropolitan area. So even though Multnomah County is dealing with these issues, a lot of these kids have come throughout the state. So any questions for anyone on the panel? Michael.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you finding that many of these children are coming from culturally diverse backgrounds? You know, that is, you know, maybe they're not fluent in English, there are cultural issues, perhaps they're escaping from, you know, they've left their families because of cultural conflicts, with their parents being more traditional in some ways. And I'm just wondering if there is a sort of cultural component to their treatment in the short term, as well, obviously, as in the long term.
Yeah. Chair Tomei, representing Embro. I think these victims span the gamut as far as cultural as well as socioeconomic backgrounds. I think it has, what I have been seeing, it has less to do with the culture they're brought up in, and more to do with their home life, so to speak, and some self-esteem issues, some abuse issues as well. One thing I wanted to mention that I don't know if we made clear enough is one of the things that is very difficult is it is very hard for them to even admit what is happening to them. So in order to find data and to identify these individuals takes a lot of sometimes circumstantial evidence, as trial attorneys like to say, or sometimes long thorough investigations to connect the dots. But I think they run the gamut of cultures as well as socioeconomic background is what I'm seeing out there on the street for the children I see.
Chair Tomei, Representative Demereaux, I appreciate the question, because when we talk about treatment programs out at juvenile, the juvenile detention facility, cultural sensitivity is right at the top of the list, and it's there because it's important. One of the issues we have, not only with this population, but with others, is being able to understand what those needs are. As you might imagine, there's an initial reluctance on the part of the youth to share with us very important information that we need to address that important issue. But we've got good folks out there, and I'm confident that if anyone can talk with these youth and get to those points, it's them.
Chair Tomei, if I may, I know you asked a question, Representative Dembrough, about culture. That the 138 that were served in DHS, we do have a breakdown on race and ethnicity, and 6.5% were Asian, 50% were Caucasian, 29.7% were African American, 6.5% Hispanic, 3.6% Native American, and 3.6% were unknown.
Nikki, could you send that information to the
Absolutely.
Committee staff, and we'll send it to all the committee members? Thank you. Representative?
Well, part of this is a comment. First of all, thank you for the information, because it's very eye-opening, but I guess it's just more of an information piece, as I know myself and Representative Bailey have a bill on teen dating violence. And so this is something that I'm grateful that there's this kind of awareness, to realize that I would assume that could also be a component, because what the bill basically is education at a very early level in public schools. And so, as I know, self-esteem is a huge issue with your victims, and hopefully we can start working with that also, because this is a, like I say, if this is an area that is not just low socioeconomic or one race or another race or whatever, it starts out as a self-esteem issue. So hopefully we'll be able to deal with that. So any help that we can give you, and vice versa, we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for your help.
Any further questions? Thank you all. Very, very helpful and important information. And thanks for coming today. And colleagues, my office does have some legislation regarding this issue, and I'd be glad to have all of you look at that and see if you'd be interested in signing on to it. That would be terrific. Thank you. Okay. We are closing the informational part of this committee hearing. Thanks all of you came today, and especially those who are working with these children. I know what a difficult situation this is. Thank you. And my staff was here. She no longer is. But I hope that you will give my staff contact information so we can...
Yeah, we have some information we'd like to get to you based on what we've heard today. So.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Okay. Colleagues, now we're going to open up a work session. We're going to introduce some committee bills. And I'm going to ask folks to take this conversation outside, please. Okay. We have three committee bills, and I want to preface this by saying that when I'd like to ask you to vote these. What are we saying? Vote them to be admitted as committee bills?
Introduce as committee bills.
Yeah, introduce as committee bills. That doesn't mean you're going to vote necessarily on these. They're just going to be presented as committee bills, and I'd appreciate your vote, too. Okay, the first one is LC 1121, and I think you've received the summary of each of these. And this is regarding maternal mental health, and we had hearings on this during this last session. And the other one is regarding birth anomalies, and we've also had hearings on this issue during this session. And we also heard today about the public guardian and conservator task force. So, and you have a summary of them in your packet. So, does Representative Boone have
a motion?
Oh, any questions? Representative Boone.
Chair Tomei, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 1121, dated 11-19-10, LC 2069, dated 10-25-10, and LC 2328, dated 11-15-10.
Thank you. Representative Boone moves that these three LCs be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? These three bills are introduced as committee bills. Well, that's the end of our work session. And Crippson and Maurer, you weren't here when I was giving good words about you during the beginning of the committee meeting. You do too. You have been a wonderful member of this committee, and I've really appreciated it. You've been really involved. You've asked wonderful questions. We've sometimes disagreed, but we've more often agreed on issues, and I really appreciate your support and your interest in this committee. And we will deeply miss you, really. Wish you best wishes in your future endeavors. D.C. is lucky to have you, and so are the veterans.
Yeah. Thank you. Looking forward to it. And I appreciate your chairing of the committee. As you know, coming into this, I think there were several people that were skeptical, and I think it's turned out very well.
Thank you. I think it has, too. I think it's worked out wonderfully. Yeah. So.
I was skeptical.
Well, it was three Republican men versus four Democratic women on the Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee in a change of power. And that there was a few eyebrows that were raised because of that, but it never was an issue at all.
You weren't scared of us, were you?
No. Well, it was a new process, yeah. Coming here new, but no, it was never an issue.
Good. Good.
Wonderful. Oh, I've always been scared, Deb.
Well, you've been a wonderful committee, and I feel very privileged to have worked with all of you.
Thank you.
It's been great. I've enjoyed every minute of it. So
every minute?
Every minute.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's quite a statement.
Yeah. And that isn't true of every committee I'm on, believe me. So, yeah. Thank you all so much. And thank to staff.
Yeah,
Rick has been. Oh, golly. I want to hold on to Rick forever. And you too. Both of you are wonderful staff. You've been terrific. I appreciate it. So any last words from anyone?
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. So this is the last of the House Interim Committee on Human Services. Yeah. Amen.
And we'll be ready.